Chapter 1. Although I am an old man, night is generally my time for walking. In the summer I often leave home early in the morning, and roam about fields and lanes all day, or even escape for days or weeks together, but, saving in the country, I seldom go out until after dark, though, heaven be thanked, I love its light and feel the cheerfulness it sheds upon the earth, as much as any creature living. I have fallen insensibly into this habit, both because it favors my infirmity and because it affords me greater opportunity of speculating on the characters and occupations of those who fill the streets. The glare and hurry of broad noon are not adapted to idle pursuits like mine. A glimpse of passing faces caught by the light of a street lamp or a shop window is often better for my purpose than their full revelation in the daylight, and, if I must add the truth, night is kinder in this respect than day, which too often destroys an air-built castle at the moment of its completion, without the least ceremony or remorse. That constant pacing to and fro, that never-ending restlessness, that incessant tread of feet wearing the rough stone smooth and glossy, is it not a wonder how the dwellers in narrow ways can bear to hear it? Think of a sick man in such a place as St. Martin's Court, listening to the footsteps, and in the midst of pain and weariness obliged, despite himself, as though it were a task he must perform, to detect the child's step from the man's, the slipshod beggar from the booted exquisite, the lounging from the busy, the dull heel of the sauntering outcast from the quick tread of an expectant pleasure seeker. Think of the hum and noise always being present to his sense, and of the stream of life that will not stop, pouring on, on, through all his restless dreams, as if he were condemned to lie, dead but conscious, in a noisy churchyard, and had no hope of rest for centuries to come. Then, the crowds forever passing and repassing on the bridges, on those which are free of toll at last, where many stop on fine evenings looking listlessly down upon the water with some vague idea that by and by it runs between green banks which grow wider and wider until at last it joins the broad vast sea, where some halt to rest from heavy loads and think as they look over the parapet that to smoke and lounge away one's life, and lie sleeping in the sun upon a hot tarpaulin, in a dull, slow, sluggish barge, must be happiness unalloyed, and where some, and a very different class, pause with heavier loads than they, remembering to have heard or read in old time that drowning was not a hard death, but of all means of suicide the easiest and best. Covent Garden Market at sunrise too, in the spring or summer, when the fragrance of sweet flowers is in the air, overpowering even the unwholesome streams of last night's debauchery, and driving the dusky thrush, whose cage has hung outside a garret window all night long, half mad with joy. Poor bird! The only neighboring thing at all akin to the other little captives, some of whom, shrinking from the hot hands of drunken purchasers, lie drooping on the path already, while others, soddened by close contact, await the time when they shall be watered and freshened up to please more sober company, and make old clerks who pass them on their road to business, wonder what has filled their breasts with visions of the country. But my present purpose is not to expatiate upon my walks. The story I am about to relate, and to which I shall recur at intervals, arose out of one of these rambles, and thus I have been led to speak of them by way of preface. One night I had roamed into the city, and was walking slowly on in my usual way, musing upon a great many things, when I was arrested by an inquiry, the purport of which did not reach me, but which seemed to be addressed to myself, and was preferred in a soft sweet voice that struck me very pleasantly. I turned hastily round and found at my elbow a pretty little girl, who begged to be directed to a certain street at a considerable distance, and indeed in quite another quarter of the town. "It is a very long way from here," said I, "my child."
"I know that, sir," she replied timidly. "I am afraid it is a very long way, for I came from there tonight."
"Alone?" said I, in some surprise.
"Oh, yes, I don't mind that, but I am a little frightened now, for I had lost my road."
"And what made you ask it of me? Suppose I should tell you wrong?"
"I am sure you will not do that," said the little creature. "You are such a very old gentleman, and walk so slow yourself."
I cannot describe how much I was impressed by this appeal and the energy with which it was made, which brought a tear into the child's clear eye, and made her slight figure tremble as she looked up into my face.
"Come," said I, "I'll take you there."
She put her hand in mine as confidingly as if she had known me from her cradle, and we trudged away together, the little creature accommodating her pace to mine, and rather seeming to lead and take care of me than I to be protecting her. I observed that every now and then she stole a curious look at my face, as if to make quite sure that I was not deceiving her, and that these glances, very sharp and keen they were too, seemed to increase her confidence at every repetition. For my part, my curiosity and interest were at least equal to the child's, for child she certainly was, although I thought it probably from what I could make out, that her very small and delicate frame imparted a peculiar youthfulness to her appearance.
Though more scantily attired than she might have been, she was dressed with perfect neatness, and betrayed no marks of poverty or neglect. "Who has sent you so far by yourself?" said I.
"Someone who is very kind to me, sir."
"And what have you been doing?"
"That, I must not tell," said the child firmly. There was something in the manner of this reply which caused me to look at the little creature with an involuntary expression of surprise, for I wondered what kind of errand it might be that occasioned her to be prepared for questioning. Her quick eye seemed to read my thoughts, for as it met mine she added that there was no harm in what she had been doing, but it was a great secret, a secret which she did not even know herself. This was said with no appearance of cunning or deceit, but with an unsuspicious frankness that bore the impress of truth. She walked on as before, growing more familiar with me as we proceeded and talking cheerfully by the way, but she said no more about her home, beyond remarking that we were going quite a new road and asking if it were a short one. While we were thus engaged, I revolved in my mind 100 different explanations of the riddle and rejected them every one. I really felt ashamed to take advantage of the ingenuousness or grateful feeling of the child for the purpose of gratifying my curiosity. I love these little people, and it is not a slight thing when they, who are so fresh from God, love us. As I had felt pleased at first by her confidence, I determined to deserve it, and to do credit to the nature which had prompted her to repose it in me. There was no reason, however, why I should refrain from seeing the person who had inconsiderately sent her to so great a distance by night and alone, and as it was not improbable that if she found herself near home she might take farewell of me and deprive me of the opportunity, I avoided the most frequented ways and took the most intricate, and thus it was not until we arrived in the street itself that she knew where we were. Clapping her hands with pleasure and running on before me for a short distance, my little acquaintance stopped at a door and remaining on the step till I came up knocked at it when I joined her. A part of this door was of glass unprotected by any shutter, which I did not observe at first, for all was very dark and silent within, and I was anxious, as indeed the child was also, for an answer to our summons. When she had knocked twice or thrice there was a noise as if some person were moving inside, and at length a faint light appeared through the glass which, as it approached very slowly, the bearer having to make his way through a great many scattered articles, enabled me to see both what kind of person it was who advanced and what kind of place it was through which he came. It was an old man with long gray hair, whose face and figure as he held the light above his head and looked before him as he approached, I could plainly see. Though much altered by age, I fancied I could recognize in his spare and slender form something of that delicate mold which I had noticed in the child. Their bright blue eyes were certainly alike, but his face was so deeply furrowed and so very full of care, that here all resemblance ceased. The place through which he made his way at leisure was one of those receptacles for old and curious things which seem to crouch in odd corners of this town and to hide their musty treasures from the public eye in jealousy and distrust. There were suits of mail standing like ghosts in armor here and there, fantastic carvings brought from monkish cloisters, rusty weapons of various kinds, distorted figures in china and wood and iron and ivory, tapestry and strange furniture that might have been designed in dreams. The haggard aspect of the little old man was wonderfully suited to the place. He might have groped among old churches and tombs and deserted houses and gathered all the spoils with his own hands. There was nothing in the whole collection but was in keeping with himself, nothing that looked older or more worn than he. As he turned the key in the lock, he surveyed me with some astonishment which was not diminished when he looked from me to my companion. The door being opened, the child addressed him as grandfather, and told him the little story of our companionship. "Why, bless thee, child," said the old man, patting her on the head, "how couldst thou miss thy way? What if I had lost thee, Nell?"
"I would have found my way back to you, grandfather," said the child boldly, "never fear." The old man kissed her, then turning to me and begging me to walk in, I did so. The door was closed and locked. Preceding me with the light, he led me through the place I had already seen from without, into a small sitting room behind, in which was another door opening into a kind of closet, where I saw a little bed that a fairy might have slept in. It looked so very small and was so prettily arranged. The child took a candle and tripped into this little room, leaving the old man and me together.
"You must be tired, sir," said he as he placed a chair near the fire. "How can I thank you?"
"By taking more care of your grandchild another time, my good friend," I replied.
"More care?" said the old man in a shrill voice. "More care of Nellie? Why, whoever loved a child as I love Nell?"
He said this with such evident surprise that I was perplexed what answer to make, and the more so because, coupled with something feeble and wandering in his manner, there were in his face marks of deep and anxious thought which convinced me that he could not be, as I had been at first inclined to suppose, in a state of dotage or imbecility.
"I don't think you consider," I began.
"I don't consider,"
cried the old man, interrupting me, I don't consider her. Ah, how little you know of the truth. Little Nelly, little Nelly.
It would be impossible for any man, I care not what his form of speech might be, to express more affection than the dealer in curiosities did, in these four words. I waited for him to speak again, but he rested his chin upon his hand and, shaking his head twice or thrice, fixed his eyes upon the fire. While we were sitting thus in silence, the door of the closet opened, and the child returned, her light brown hair hanging loose about her neck, and her face flushed with the haste she had made to rejoin us. She busied herself immediately in preparing supper, and while she was thus engaged I remarked that the old man took an opportunity of observing me more closely than he had done yet. I was surprised to see that all this time everything was done by the child, and that there appeared to be no other persons but ourselves in the house. I took advantage of a moment when she was absent to venture a hint on this point, to which the old man replied that there were few grown persons as trustworthy or as careful as she. It always grieves me, I observed, roused by what I took to be his selfishness, it always grieves me to contemplate the initiation of children into the ways of life, when they are scarcely more than infants. It checks their confidence and simplicity, two of the best qualities that heaven gives them, and demands that they share our sorrows before they are capable of entering into our enjoyments. It will never check hers, said the old man, looking steadily at me, the springs are too deep. Besides, the children of the poor know but few pleasures. Even the cheap delights of childhood must be bought and paid for. But forgive me for saying this, you are surely not so very poor, said I.
She is not my child, sir, returned the old man. Her mother was, and she was poor. I save nothing, not a penny, though I live as you see, but he laid his hand upon my arm and leant forward to whisper, she shall be rich one of these days, and a fine lady. Don't you think ill of me because I use her help. She gives it cheerfully as you see, and it would break her heart if she knew that I suffered anybody else to do for me what her little hands could undertake. I don't consider exclamation mark, he cried with sudden querulousness, why, God knows that this one child is the thought and object of my life, and yet he never prospers me, no, never. At this juncture, the subject of our conversation again returned, and the old man, motioning to me to approach the table, broke off, and said no more. We had scarcely begun our repast when there was a knock at the door by which I had entered, and Nell bursting into a hearty laugh, which I was rejoiced to hear, for it was childlike and full of hilarity, said it was no doubt dear old Kit coming back at last.
Foolish Nell! Said the old man, fondling with her hair. She always laughs at poor Kit. The child laughed again more heartily than before, and I could not help smiling from pure sympathy. The little old man took up a candle and went to open the door. When he came back, Kit was at his heels. Kit was a shock-headed, shambling, awkward lad with an uncommonly wide mouth, very red cheeks, a turned-up nose, and certainly the most comical expression of face I ever saw. He stopped short at the door on seeing a stranger, twirled in his hand a perfectly round old hat without any vestige of a brim, and resting himself now on one leg and now on the other and changing them constantly, stood in the doorway, looking into the parlor with the most extraordinary leer I ever beheld. I entertained a grateful feeling towards the boy from that minute, for I felt that he was the comedy of the child's life.
A long way, wasn't it, Kit? Said the little old man.
Why, then, it was a goodish stretch, master, returned Kit. Of course you have come back hungry?
Why, then, I do consider myself rather so, master, was the answer.
The lad had a remarkable manner of standing sideways as he spoke, and thrusting his head forward over his shoulder, as if he could not get at his voice without that accompanying action. I think he would have amused one anywhere, but the child's exquisite enjoyment of his oddity, and the relief it was to find that there was something she associated with merriment in a place that appeared so unsuited to her, were quite irresistible. It was a great point too that Kit himself was flattered by the sensation he created, and after several efforts to preserve his gravity, burst into a loud roar, and so stood with his mouth wide open and his eyes nearly shut, laughing violently. The old man had again relapsed into his former abstraction and took no notice of what passed, but I remarked that when her laugh was over, the child's bright eyes were dimmed with tears, called forth by the fullness of heart with which she welcomed her uncouth favorite after the little anxiety of the night. As for Kit himself, whose laugh had been all the time one of that sort which very little would change into a cry, he carried a large slice of bread and meat and a mug of beer into a corner, and applied himself to disposing of them with great voracity.
Ah! Said the old man, turning to me with a sigh, as if I had spoken to him but that moment, you don't know what you say when you tell me that I don't consider her.
You must not attach too great weight to a remark founded on first appearances, my friend, said I.
No, returned the old man thoughtfully, No. Come hither, Nell. The little girl hastened from her seat, and put her arm about his neck.
Do I love thee, Nell? Said he. Say, do I love thee, Nell, or no?
The child only answered by her caresses, and laid her head upon his breast.
Why dost thou sob? Said the grandfather, pressing her closer to him and glancing towards me. Is it because thou knowest I love thee, and dost not like that I should seem to doubt it by my question?
Well then let us say I love thee dearly.
Indeed, indeed you do, replied the child with great earnestness, Kit knows you do.
Kit, who in dispatching his bread and meat had been swallowing 2/3 of his knife at every mouthful with the coolness of a juggler, stopped short in his operations on being thus appealed to, and bawled nobody isn't such a fool as to say he doesn't, after which he incapacitated himself for further conversation by taking a most prodigious sandwich at one bite.
She is poor now, said the old man, patting the child's cheek, but I say again that the time is coming when she shall be rich. It has been a long time coming, but it must come at last, a very long time, but it surely must come. It has come to other men who do nothing but waste and riot. When will it come to me?
I am very happy as I am, grandfather, said the child.
Dush, dush, returned the old man, thou dost not know how shouldst thou. Then he muttered again between his teeth, the time must come, I am very sure it must. It will be all the better for coming late, and then he sighed and fell into his former musing state, and still holding the child between his knees appeared to be insensible to everything round him. By this time it wanted but a few minutes of midnight and I rose to go, which recalled him to himself.
One moment, sir, he said, now, Kit, near midnight, boy, and you still here.
Get home, and be true to your time in the morning, for there's work to do. Good night.
There, bid him good night, Nell, and let him be gone.
Good night, Kit, said the child, her eyes lighting up with merriment and kindness.
Good night, Miss Nell, returned the boy.
And thank this gentleman, interposed the old man, but for whose care I might have lost my little girl tonight.
No, no, master, said Kit, that won't do, that won't.
What do you mean? Cried the old man.
I'd have found her, master, said Kit, I'd have found her. I'll bet that I'd find her if she was above ground, I would, as quick as anybody, master.
Ha, ha, ha. Once more opening his mouth and shutting his eyes, and laughing like a stentor, Kit gradually backed to the door, and roared himself out. Free of the room, the boy was not slow in taking his departure. When he had gone, and the child was occupied in clearing the table, the old man said,
I haven't seemed to thank you, sir, for what you have done tonight, but I do thank you humbly and heartily, and so does she, and her thanks are better worth than mine. I should be sorry that you went away, and thought I was unmindful of your goodness, or careless of her. I am not indeed.
I was sure of that, I said, from what I had seen. But, I added, may I ask you a question?
Eh, sir, replied the old man, what is it?
This delicate child, said I, with so much beauty and intelligence, has she nobody to care for her but you? Has she no other companion or adviser?
No, he returned, looking anxiously in my face, no, and she wants no other.
But are you not fearful, said I, that you may misunderstand a charge so tender? I am sure you mean well, but are you quite certain that you know how to execute such a trust as this? I am an old man, like you, and I am actuated by an old man's concern in all that is young and promising. Do you not think that what I have seen of you and this little creature tonight must have an interest not wholly free from pain?
Sir, rejoined the old man after a moment's silence, I have no right to feel hurt at what you say. It is true that in many respects I am the child, and she the grown person that you have seen already. But waking or sleeping, by night or day, in sickness or health, she is the one object of my care, and if you knew of how much care, you would look on me with different eyes, you would indeed.
Ah! It's a weary life for an old man, a weary, weary life, but there is a great end to gain and that I keep before me. Seeing that he was in a state of excitement and impatience, I turned to put on an outer coat which I had thrown off on entering the room, purposing to say no more. I was surprised to see the child standing patiently by with a cloak upon her arm, and in her hand a hat, and stick.
Those are not mine, my dear, said I.
No, returned the child, they are grandfather's.
But he is not going out tonight.
Oh, yes, he is, said the child, with a smile.
And what becomes of you, my pretty one?
Me. I stay here, of course. I always do. I looked in astonishment towards the old man, but he was, or feigned to be,
busied in the arrangement of his dress. From him I looked back to the slight gentle figure of the child. Alone. In that gloomy place all the long, dreary night. She evinced no consciousness of my surprise, but cheerfully helped the old man with his cloak, and when he was ready took a candle to light us out. Finding that we did not follow as she expected, she looked back with a smile and waited for us. The old man showed by his face that he plainly understood the cause of my hesitation, but he merely signed to me with an inclination of the head to pass out of the room before him, and remained silent. I had no resource but to comply. When we reached the door, the child, setting down the candle, turned to say good night and raised her face to kiss me. Then she ran to the old man, who folded her in his arms and bade God bless her. "Sleep soundly, Nell," he said in a low voice, "and angels guard thy bed. Do not forget thy prayers, my sweet." "No, indeed," answered the child fervently, "they make me feel so happy." "That's well, I know they do, they should," said the old man. "Bless thee 100 times. Early in the morning I shall be home." "You'll not ring twice," returned the child. "The bell wakes me, even in the middle of a dream." With this, they separated. The child opened the door, now guarded by a shutter which I had heard the boy put out before he left the house, and with another farewell whose clear and tender note I have recalled 1,000 times, held it until we had passed out. The old man paused a moment while it was gently closed and fastened on the inside, and satisfied that this was done, walked on at a slow pace. At the street corner he stopped, and regarding me with a troubled countenance said that our ways were widely different and that he must take his leave. I would have spoken, but summoning up more alacrity than might have been expected in one of his appearance, he hurried away. I could see that twice or thrice he looked back as if to ascertain if I were still watching him, or perhaps to assure himself that I was not following at a distance. The obscurity of the night favored his disappearance, and his figure was soon beyond my sight. I remained standing on the spot where he had left me, unwilling to depart, and yet unknowing why I should loiter there. I looked wistfully into the street we had lately quitted, and after a time directed my steps that way. I passed and repassed the house, and stopped and listened at the door. All was dark, and silent as the grave. Yet I lingered about, and could not tear myself away, thinking of all possible harm that might happen to the child of fires and robberies and even murder, and feeling as if some evil must ensue if I turned my back upon the place. The closing of a door or window in the street brought me before the curiosity dealers once more. I crossed the road and looked up at the house to assure myself that the noise had not come from there. No, it was black, cold, and lifeless as before. There were few passengers astir, the street was sad and dismal, and pretty well my own. A few stragglers from the theaters hurried by, and now and then I turned aside to avoid some noisy drunkard as he reeled homewards, but these interruptions were not frequent and soon ceased. The clocks struck 1. Still I paced up and down, promising myself that every time should be the last, and breaking faith with myself on some new plea as often as I did so. The more I thought of what the old man had said, and of his looks and bearing, the less I could account for what I had seen and heard. I had a strong misgiving that his nightly absence was for no good purpose. I had only come to know the fact through the innocence of the child, and though the old man was by at the time, and saw my undisguised surprise, he had preserved a strange mystery upon the subject and offered no word of explanation. These reflections naturally recalled again more strongly than before his haggard face, his wandering manner, his restless, anxious looks. His affection for the child might not be inconsistent with villainy of the worst kind, even that very affection was in itself an extraordinary contradiction, or how could he leave her thus? Disposed as I was to think badly of him, I never doubted that his love for her was real. I could not admit the thought, remembering what had passed between us, and the tone of voice in which he had called her by her name. "Stay here, of course," the child had said in answer to my question, "I always do. What could take him from home by night, and every night?" I called up all the strange tales I had ever heard of dark and secret deeds committed in great towns and escaping detection for a long series of years. Wild as many of these stories were, I could not find one adapted to this mystery, which only became the more impenetrable, in proportion as I sought to solve it. Occupied with such thoughts as these, and a crowd of others all tending to the same point, I continued to pace the street for 2 long hours. At length the rain began to descend heavily, and then, overpowered by fatigue though no less interested than I had been at first, I engaged the nearest coach and so got home. A cheerful fire was blazing on the hearth, the lamp burnt brightly, my clock received me with its old familiar welcome, everything was quiet, warm and cheering, and in happy contrast to the gloom and darkness I had quitted. But all that night, waking or in my sleep, the same thoughts recurred and the same images retained possession of my brain. I had ever before me the old dark murky rooms, the gaunt suits of mail with their ghostly silent air, the faces all awry, grinning from wood and stone, the dust and rust and worm that lives in wood and alone in the midst of all this lumber and decay and ugly age, the beautiful child in her gentle slumber, smiling through her light and sunny dreams. Chapter 2. After combating, for nearly a week, the feeling which impelled me to revisit the place I had quitted under the circumstances already detailed, I yielded to it at length, and determining that this time I would present myself by the light of day, bent my steps thither early in the morning. I walked past the house, and took several turns in the street, with that kind of hesitation which is natural to a man who is conscious that the visit he is about to pay is unexpected, and may not be very acceptable. However, as the door of the shop was shut, and it did not appear likely that I should be recognized by those within, if I continued merely to pass up and down before it, I soon conquered this irresolution, and found myself in the curiosity dealer's warehouse. The old man and another person were together in the back part, and there seemed to have been high words between them, for their voices, which were raised to a very high pitch, suddenly stopped on my entering, and the old man, advancing hastily towards me, said in a tremulous tone that he was very glad I had come. "You interrupted us at a critical moment," said he, pointing to the man whom I had found in company with him. "This fellow will murder me one of these days. He would have done so, long ago, if he had dared." "Bah! You would swear away my life if you could," returned the other, after bestowing a stare and a frown on me, "we all know that." "I almost think I could," cried the old man, turning feebly upon him. "If oaths, or prayers, or words, could rid me of you, they should. I would be quit of you, and would be relieved if you were dead." "I know it," returned the other. "I said so, didn't I? But neither oaths, or prayers, nor words, will kill me, and therefore I live, and mean to live." "And his mother died," cried the old man, passionately clasping his hands and looking upward, "and this is heaven's justice." The other stood lounging with his foot upon a chair, and regarded him with a contemptuous sneer. He was a young man of 21 or thereabouts, well made, and certainly handsome, though the expression of his face was far from prepossessing, having in common with his manner and even his dress, a dissipated, insolent air which repelled one. "Justice or no justice," said the young fellow, "here I am and here I shall stop till such time as I think fit to go, unless you send for assistance to put me out, which you won't do, I know. I tell you again that I want to see my sister."
"Your sister?" said the old man bitterly.
"Ah! You can't change the relationship," returned the other. "If you could, you'd have done it long ago. I want to see my sister, that you keep cooped up here, poisoning her mind with your sly secrets and pretending an affection for her that you may work her to death, and add a few scraped shillings every week to the money you can hardly count. I want to see her, and I will. Here's a moralist to talk of poisoned minds. Here's a generous spirit to scorn scraped up shillings," cried the old man, turning from him to me. "A profligate, sir, who has forfeited every claim not only upon those who have the misfortune to be of his blood, but upon society which knows nothing of him but his misdeeds. A liar too," he added, in a lower voice as he drew closer to me, "who knows how dear she is to me, and seeks to wound me even there, because there is a stranger nearby."
"Strangers are nothing to me, grandfather," said the young fellow, catching at the word, "nor I to them, I hope. The best they can do, is to keep an eye to their business and leave me to mine. There's a friend of mine waiting outside, and as it seems that I may have to wait some time, I'll call him in, with your leave." Saying this, he stepped to the door, and looking down the street beckoned several times to some unseen person, who, to judge from the air of impatience with which these signals were accompanied, required a great quantity of persuasion to induce him to advance. At length there sauntered up, on the opposite side of the way, with a bad pretense of passing by accident, a figure conspicuous for its dirty smartness, which after a great many frowns and jerks of the head, in resistance of the invitation, ultimately crossed the road and was brought into the shop.
"There. It's Dick Swiveller," said the young fellow, pushing him in.
"Sit down, Swiveller."
"But is the old man agreeable?" said Mr. Swiveller in an undertone. Mr. Swiveller complied, and looking about him with a propitiatory smile, observed that last week was a fine week for the ducks, and this week was a fine week for the dust. He also observed that whilst standing by the post at the street corner, he had observed a pig with a straw in his mouth issuing out of the tobacco shop, from which appearance he augured that another fine week for the ducks was approaching, and that rain would certainly ensue. He furthermore took occasion to apologize for any negligence that might be perceptible in his dress, on the ground that last night he had had the sun very strong in his eyes, by which expression he was understood to convey to his hearers in the most delicate manner possible, the information that he had been extremely drunk.
But what, said Mr. Swiveller with a sigh, what is the odds so long as the fire of soul is kindled at the taper of conviviality, and the wing of friendship never molts a feather? What is the odds so long as the spirit is expanded by means of rosy wine, and the present moment is the least happiest of our existence? You needn't act the chairman here, said his friend, half aside.
Fred! Cried Mr. Swiveller, tapping his nose, a word to the wise is sufficient for them. We may be good and happy without riches, Fred.
Say not another syllable. I know my cue, smart is the word. Only one little whisper, Fred, is the old man friendly?
Never you mind, replied his friend.
Right again, quite right, said Mr. Swiveller, caution is the word, and caution is the act. With that, he winked as if in preservation of some deep secret, and folding his arms and leaning back in his chair, looked up at the ceiling with profound gravity. It was perhaps not very unreasonable to suspect from what had already passed, that Mr. Swiveller was not quite recovered from the effects of the powerful sunlight to which he had made allusion, but if no such suspicion had been awakened by his speech, his wiry hair, dull eyes, and sallow face would still have been strong witnesses against him. His attire was not, as he had himself hinted, remarkable for the nicest arrangement, but was in a state of disorder which strongly induced the idea that he had gone to bed in it. It consisted of a brown body coat with a great many brass buttons up the front and only one behind, a bright check neckerchief, a plaid waistcoat, soiled white trousers, and a very limp hat, worn with the wrong side foremost, to hide a hole in the brim. The breast of his coat was ornamented with an outside pocket from which there peeped forth the cleanest end of a very large and very ill-favored handkerchief. His dirty wristbands were pulled on as far as possible and ostentatiously folded back over his cuffs. He displayed no gloves, and carried a yellow cane having at the top a bone hand with the semblance of a ring on its little finger and a black ball in its grasp. With all these personal advantages, to which may be added a strong savor of tobacco smoke, and a prevailing greasiness of appearance, Mr. Swiveller leant back in his chair with his eyes fixed on the ceiling, and occasionally pitching his voice to the needful key, obliged the company with a few bars of an intensely dismal air, and then, in the middle of a note, relapsed into his former silence. The old man sat himself down in a chair, and with folded hands, looked sometimes at his grandson and sometimes at his strange companion, as if he were utterly powerless and had no resource but to leave them to do as they pleased. The young man reclined against a table at no great distance from his friend, in apparent indifference to everything that had passed, and I who felt the difficulty of any interference, notwithstanding that the old man had appealed to me, both by words and looks made the best feint I could of being occupied in examining some of the goods that were disposed for sale, and paying very little attention to a person before me. The silence was not of long duration, for Mr. Swiveller, after favoring us with several melodious assurances that his heart was in the Highlands, and that he wanted but his Arab steed as a preliminary to the achievement of great feats of valor and loyalty, removed his eyes from the ceiling and subsided into prose again.
Fred, said Mr. Swiveller stopping short, as if the idea had suddenly occurred to him, and speaking in the same audible whisper as before, is the old man friendly?
What does it matter? Returned his friend peevishly.
No, but is he? Said Dick.
Yes, of course. What do I care whether he is or not? Emboldened as it seemed by this reply to enter into a more general conversation, Mr. Swiveller plainly laid himself out to captivate our attention. He began by remarking that soda water, though a good thing in the abstract, was apt to lay hold upon the stomach unless qualified with ginger, or a small infusion of brandy, which latter article he held to be preferable in all cases, saving for the one consideration of expense. Nobody venturing to dispute these positions, he proceeded to observe that the human hair was a great retainer of tobacco smoke, and that the young gentlemen of Westminster and Eton, after eating vast quantities of apples to conceal any scent of cigars from their anxious friends, were usually detected in consequence of their heads possessing this remarkable property. When he concluded that if the Royal Society would turn their attention to the circumstance, and endeavor to find in the resources of science a means of preventing such untoward revelations, they might indeed be looked upon as benefactors to mankind. These opinions being equally incontrovertible with those he had already pronounced, he went on to inform us that Jamaica rum, though unquestionably an agreeable spirit of great richness and flavor, had the drawback of remaining constantly present to the taste next day, and nobody being venturous enough to argue this point either. He increased in confidence and became yet more companionable and communicative.
It's a devil of a thing, gentlemen, said Mr. Swiveller, when relations fall out and disagree. If the wing of friendship should never molt a feather, the wing of relationship should never be clipped, but be always expanded and serene.
Why should a grandson and grandfather peg away at each other with mutual violence when all might be bliss and concord? Why not join hands and forget it?
Hold your tongue, said his friend.
Sir, replied Mr. Swiveller, don't you interrupt the chair. Gentlemen, how does the case stand, upon the present occasion? Here is a jolly old grandfather, I say it with the utmost respect, and here is a wild, young grandson. The jolly old grandfather says to the wild young grandson, I have brought you up and educated you, Fred, I have put you in the way of getting on in life, you have bolted a little out of course, as young fellows often do, and you shall never have another chance, nor the ghost of half a one. The wild young grandson makes answer to this and says, you're as rich can be, you have been at no uncommon expense on my account, you're saving up piles of money for my little sister that lives with you in a secret, stealthy, hugger-muggering kind of way and with no manner of enjoyment. Why can't you stand a trifle for your grown-up relation? The jolly old grandfather unto this, retorts, not only that he declines to fork out with the cheerful readiness which is always so agreeable and pleasant in a gentleman of his time of life, but that he will bow up, and call names, and make reflections whenever they meet. Then the plain question is, and it a pity that this state of things should continue, and how much better would it be for the gentleman to hand over a reasonable amount of tin, and make it all right and comfortable? Having delivered this oration with a great many waves and flourishes of the hand, Mr. Swiveller abruptly thrust the head of his cane into his mouth as if to prevent himself from impairing the effect of his speech by adding one other word. Why do you hunt and persecute me, God help me? Said the old man turning to his grandson. Why do you bring your profligate companions here? How often am I to tell you that my life is one of care and self-denial, and that I am poor? How often am I to tell you, returned the other, looking coldly at him, that I know better? You have chosen your own path, said the old man. Follow it. Leave Nell and me to toil and work. Nell will be a woman soon, returned the other, and, bread in your faith, she'll forget her brother unless he shows himself sometimes. Take care, said the old man with sparkling eyes, that she does not forget you when you would have her memory keenest. Take care that the day don't come when you walk barefoot in the streets, and she rides by in a gay carriage of her own. You mean when she has your money? Retorted the other. How like a poor man he talks. And yet, said the old man dropping his voice and speaking like one who thinks aloud, how poor we are, and what a life it is. The cause is a young child's guiltless of all harm or wrong, but nothing goes well with it. Hope and patience, hope and patience. These words were uttered in too low a tone to reach the ears of the young men. Mr. Swiveller appeared to think that they implied some mental struggle consequent upon the powerful effect of his address, for he poked his friend with his cane and whispered his conviction that he had administered a clincher, and that he expected a commission on the profits. Discovering his mistake after a while, he appeared to grow rather sleepy and discontented, and had more than once suggested the propriety of an immediate departure, when the door opened, and the child herself appeared. Chapter 3. The child was closely followed by an elderly man of remarkably hard features and forbidding aspect, and so low in stature as to be quite a dwarf, though his head and face were large enough for the body of a giant. His black eyes were restless, sly, and cunning, his mouth and chin, bristly with the stubble of a coarse hard beard, and his complexion was one of that kind which never looks clean or wholesome. But what added most to the grotesque expression of his face was a ghastly smile, which, appearing to be the mere result of habit and to have no connection with any mirthful or complacent feeling, constantly revealed the few discolored fangs that were yet scattered in his mouth, and gave him the aspect of a panting dog. His dress consisted of a large high-crowned hat, a worn dark suit, a pair of capacious shoes, and a dirty white neckerchief sufficiently limp and crumpled to disclose the greater portion of his wiry throat. Such hair as he had was of a grizzled black, cut short and straight upon his temples, and hanging in a frowsy fringe about his ears. His hands, which were of a rough, coarse grain, were very dirty, his fingernails were crooked, long, and yellow. There was ample time to note these particulars, for besides that they were sufficiently obvious without very close observation, some moments elapsed before anyone broke silence. The child advanced timidly towards her brother and put her hand in his. The dwarf, if we may call him so, glanced keenly at all present, and the curiosity dealer, who plainly had not expected his uncouth visitor, seemed disconcerted and embarrassed. Ah! Said the dwarf, who with his hand stretched out above his eyes had been surveying the young man attentively, that should be your grandson, neighbor. Say rather that he should not be, replied the old man. But he is. And that? Said the dwarf, pointing to Dick Swiveller. Some friend of his, as welcome here as he, said the old man. And that? Inquired the dwarf, wheeling round and pointing straight at me. "A gentleman who was so good as to bring Nell home the other night when she lost her way, coming from your house." The little man turned to the child as if to chide her or express his wonder, but as she was talking to the young man, held his peace, and bent his head to listen.
"Well, Nelly," said the young fellow aloud. "Do they teach you to hate me, eh?"
"No, no. For shame. Oh, no," cried the child.
"To love me, perhaps?" pursued her brother with a sneer.
"To do neither," she returned. "They never speak to me about you. Indeed they never do."
"I dare be bound for that," he said, darting a bitter look at the grandfather. "I dare be bound for that, Nell. Oh, I believe you there."
"But I love you dearly, Fred," said the child.
"No doubt.
I do indeed, and always will," the child repeated with great emotion, "but oh, if you would leave off vexing him and making him unhappy, then I could love you more."
"I see," said the young man, as he stooped carelessly over the child, and having kissed her, pushed her from him, "there, get you away now you have said your lesson. You needn't whimper. We part good friends enough, if that's the matter." He remained silent, following her with his eyes, until she had gained her little room and closed the door, and then turning to the dwarf, said abruptly,
"Harkee, mister."
"Meaning me?"
returned the dwarf. "Quilp is my name. You might remember. It's not a long one, Daniel Quilp."
"Harkee, Mr. Quilp, then," pursued the other, "you have some influence with my grandfather there."
"Some," said Mr. Quilp emphatically.
"And are in a few of his mysteries and secrets."
"A few," replied Quilp, with equal dryness.
"Then let me tell him once for all, through you, that I will come into and go out of this place as often as I like, so long as he keeps Nell here, and that if he wants to be quit of me, he must first be quit of her. What have I done to be made a bugbear of, and to be shunned and dreaded as if I brought the plague? He'll tell you that I have no natural affection, and that I care no more for Nell, for her own sake, than I do for him. Let him say so. I care for the whim, then, of coming to and fro and reminding her of my existence. I will see her when I please. That's my point. I came here today to maintain it, and I'll come here again 50 times with the same object and always with the same success. I said I would stop till I had gained it. I have done so, and now my visit's ended. Come, Dick."
"Stop!" cried Mr. Swiveller, as his companion turned toward the door.
"Sir!
Sir, I am your humble servant," said Mr. Quilp, to whom the monosyllable was addressed.
"Before I leave the gay and festive scene, and halls of dazzling light, sir," said Mr. Swiveller, "I will, with your permission, attempt a slight remark. I came here, sir, this day, under the impression that the old man was friendly."
"Proceed, sir," said Daniel Quilp, for the order had made a sudden stop.
"Inspired by this idea and the sentiments it awakened, sir, and feeling as a mutual friend that badgering, baiting, and bullying, was not the sort of thing calculated to expand the souls and promote the social harmony of the contending parties, I took upon myself to suggest a course which is the course to be adopted to the present occasion. Will you allow me to whisper half a syllable, sir?" Without waiting for the permission he sought, Mr. Swiveller stepped up to the dwarf, and leaning on his shoulder and stooping down to get at his ear, said in a voice which was perfectly audible to all present,
"The watchword to the old man is fork."
"Is what?"
demanded Quilp.
"Is fork, sir, fork," replied Mr. Swiveller, slapping his pocket. "You are awake, sir?"
The dwarf nodded. Mr. Swiveller drew back and nodded likewise, then drew a little further back and nodded again, and so on. By these means he in time reached the door, where he gave a great cough to attract the dwarf's attention and gain an opportunity of expressing in dumb show the closest confidence and most inviolable secrecy. Having performed the serious pantomime that was necessary for the due conveyance of these idea, he cast himself upon his friend's track, and vanished.
"Humphrey," said the dwarf with a sour look and a shrug of his shoulders, "so much for dear relations. Thank God I acknowledge none. Nor need you either," he added, turning to the old man, "if you are not as weak as a reed, and nearly as senseless."
"What would you have me do?" he retorted in a kind of helpless desperation. "It is easy to talk and sneer. What would you have me do?"
"What would I do if I was in your case?" said the dwarf.
"Something violent, no doubt."
"You were right there," returned the little man, highly gratified by the compliment, for such he evidently considered it, and grinning like a devil as he rubbed his dirty hands together. "Ask Mrs. Quilp, pretty Mrs. Quilp, obedient, timid, loving Mrs. Quilp. But that reminds me, I have left her all alone, and she will be anxious and know not a moment's peace till I return. I know she's always in that condition when I'm away, thought she doesn't dare to say so, unless I lead her on and tell her she may speak freely and I won't be angry with her.
Oh! Well-trained Mrs. Quilp.
The creature appeared quite horrible with his monstrous head and little body, as he rubbed his hands slowly round, and round, and round again with something fantastic even in his manner of performing the slight action and, dropping his shaggy brows and cocking his chin in the air, glanced upward with a stealthy look of exultation that an imp might have copied and appropriated to himself.
"Here," he said, putting his hand into his breast and sidling up to the old man as he spoke, "I brought it myself for fear of accidents, as, being in gold, it was something large and heavy for Nell to carry in her bag. She need be accustomed to such loads betimes though, neighbor, for she will carry weight when you are dead."
"Heaven send she may." "I hope so," said the old man with something like a groan.
"Hope so," echoed the dwarf, approaching close to his ear,
"neighbor, I would I knew in what good investment all these supplies are sunk. But you are a deep man, and keep your secret close."
"My secret?" said the other with a haggard look.
"Yes, you're right, I keep it close, very close." He said no more, but taking the money turned away with a slow, uncertain step, and pressed his hand upon his head like a weary and dejected man. The dwarf watched him sharply, while he passed into the little sitting room and locked it in an iron safe above the chimney piece, and after musing for a short space, prepared to take his leave, observing that unless he made good haste, Mrs. Quilp would certainly be in fits on his return. "And so, neighbor," he added, "I'll turn my face homewards, leaving my love for Nelly and hoping she may never lose her way again, though her doing so has procured me an honor I didn't expect." With that he bowed and leered at me, and with a keen glance around which seemed to comprehend every object within his range of vision, however, small or trivial, went his way. I had several times essayed to go myself, but the old man had always opposed it and entreated me to remain. As he renewed his entreaties on our being left along, and adverted with many thanks to the former occasion of our being together, I willingly yielded to his persuasions, and sat down, pretending to examine some curious miniatures and a few old medals which he placed before me. It needed no great pressing to induce me to stay, for if my curiosity has been excited on the occasion of my first visit, it certainly was not diminished now. Nell joined us before long, and bringing some needlework to the table, sat by the old man's side. It was pleasant to observe the fresh flowers in the room, the pet bird with a green bough shading his little cage, the breath of freshness and youth which seemed to rustle through the old dull house and hover round the child. It was curious, but not so pleasant, to turn from the beauty and grace of the girl, to the stooping figure, careworn face, and jaded aspect of the old man. As he grew weaker and more feeble, what would become of this lonely little creature, poor protector as he was, say that he died, what would be her fate, then? The old man almost answered my thoughts, as he laid his hand on hers, and spoke aloud. "I'll be of better cheer, Nell," he said, "there must be good fortune in store for thee. I do not ask it for myself, but thee. Such miseries must fall on thy innocent head without it, that I cannot believe but that, being tempted, it will come at last." She looked cheerfully into his face, but made no answer. "When I think," said he, "of the many years, many in thy short life that thou hast lived with me, of my monotonous existence, knowing no companions of thy own age nor any childish pleasures, of the solitude in which thou hast grown to be what thou art, and in which thou hast lived apart from nearly all thy kind but one old man, I sometimes fear I have dealt hardly by thee, Nell."
"Grandfather!" cried the child in unfeigned surprise.
"Not in intention, oh no," said he. "I have ever looked forward to the time that should enable thee to mix among the gayest and prettiest, and take thy station with the best. But I still look forward, Nell, I still look forward, and if I should be forced to leave thee, meanwhile, how have I fitted thee for struggles with the world? The poor bird yonder is as well qualified to encounter it, and be turned adrift upon its mercies. Hark! I hear Kit outside. Go to him, Nell, go to him." She rose, and hurrying away, stopped, turned back, and put her arms about the old man's neck, then left him and hurried away again, but faster this time, to hide her falling tears.
"A word in your ear, sir," said the old man in a hurried whisper. "I have been rendered uneasy by what you said the other night, and can only plead that I have done all for the best, that it is too late to retract, if I could, though I cannot, and that I hope to triumph yet. All is for her sake. I have borne great poverty myself, and would spare her the sufferings that poverty carries with it. I would spare her the miseries that brought her mother, my own dear child, to an early grave. I would leave her not with resources which could be easily spent or squandered away, But with what would place her beyond the reach of want forever? You mark me, sir? She shall have no pittance, but a fortune. Hush. I can say no more than that, now or at any other time, and she is here again. The eagerness with which all this was poured into my ear, the trembling of the hand with which he clasped my arm, the strained and starting eyes he fixed upon me, the wild vehemence and agitation of his manner, filled me with amazement. All that I had heard and seen, and a great part of what he had said himself, led me to suppose that he was a wealthy man. I could form no comprehension of his character, unless he were one of those miserable wretches who, having made gain the sole end and object of their lives and having succeeded in amassing great riches, are constantly tortured by the dread of poverty, and beset by fears of loss and ruin. Many things he had said which I had been at a loss to understand, were quite reconcilable with the idea thus presented to me, and at length I concluded that beyond all doubt he was one of this unhappy race. The opinion was not the result of hasty consideration, for which indeed there was no opportunity at that time, as the child came directly, and soon occupied herself in preparations for giving Kit a writing lesson, of which it seemed he had a couple every week, and one regularly on that evening, to the great mirth and enjoyment both of himself and his instructress. To relate how it was a long time before his modesty could be so far prevailed upon as it admit of his sitting down in the parlor, in the presence of an unknown gentleman, how, when he did sit down, he tucked up his sleeves and squared his elbows and put his face close to the copybook and squinted horribly at the lines, how, from the very first moment of having the pen in his hand, he began to wallow in blots, and to daub himself with ink up to the very roots of his hair, how, if he did by accident form a letter properly, he immediately smeared it out again with his arm in his preparations to make another, how, at every fresh mistake, there was a fresh burst of merriment from the child and louder and not less hearty laugh from poor Kit himself, and how there was all the way through, notwithstanding, a gentle wish on her part to teach, and an anxious desire on his to learn to relate all these particulars would no doubt occupy more space and time than they deserve. It will be sufficient to say that the lesson was given that evening passed and night came on, that the old man again grew restless and impatient, that he quitted the house secretly at the same hour as before, and that the child was once more left alone within its gloomy walls. And now that I have carried this history so far in my own character and introduced these personages to the reader, I shall for the convenience of the narrative detach myself from its further course, and leave those who have prominent and necessary parts in it to speak and act for themselves. Chapter 4. Mr. and Mrs. Quilp resided on Tower Hill, and in her bower on Tower Hill Mrs. Quilp was left to pine the absence of her lord, when he quitted her on the business which he had already seen to transact. Mr. Quilp could scarcely be said to be of any particular trade or calling, though his pursuits were diversified and his occupations numerous. He collected the rents of whole colonies of filthy streets and alleys by the waterside, advanced money to the seamen and petty officers of merchant vessels, had a share in the ventures of divers mates of East Indiamen, smoked his smuggled cigars under the very nose of the custom house, and made appointments on change with men in glazed hats and round jackets pretty well every day. On the Surrey side of the river was a small rat-infested dreary yard called Quilp's Wharf, in which were a little wooden counting-house burrowing all awry in the dust as if it had fallen from the clouds and ploughed into the ground, a few fragments of rusty anchors, several large iron rings, some piles of rotten wood, and two or three heaps of old sheet copper, crumpled, cracked, and battered. On Quilp's Wharf, Daniel Quilp was a shipbreaker, yet to judge from these appearances he must either have been a shipbreaker on a very small scale, or have broken his ships up very small indeed. Neither did the place present any extraordinary aspect of life or activity, as its only human occupant was an amphibious boy in a canvas suit, whose sole change of occupation was from sitting on the head of a pile and throwing stones into the mud when the tide was out, to standing with his hands in his pockets gazing listlessly on the motion and on the bustle of the river at high water. The dwarf's lodging on Tower Hill comprised, besides the needful accommodation for himself and Mrs. Quilp, a small sleeping closet for that lady's mother, who resided with the couple and waged perpetual war with Daniel, of whom, notwithstanding, she stood in no slight dread. Indeed, the ugly creature contrived by some means or other, whether by his ugliness or his ferocity or his natural cunning, is no great matter to impress with a wholesome fear of his anger most of those with whom he was brought into daily contact and communication. Over nobody had he such complete ascendance as Mrs. Quilp herself, a pretty little, mild-spoken, blue-eyed woman, who having allied herself in wedlock to the dwarf in one of those strange infatuations of which examples are by no means scarce, performed a sound practical penance for her folly, every day of her life. It has been said that Mrs. Quilp was pining in her bower. In her bower she was, but not alone, for besides the old lady, her mother, of whom mention has recently been made,
There were present some half-dozen ladies of the neighborhood who had happened by a strange accident, and also by a little understanding among themselves, to drop in one after another, just about tea time. This being a season favorable to conversation, and the room being a cool, shady, lazy kind of place, with some plants at the open window shutting out the dust, and interposing pleasantly enough between the tea table within and the old tower without, it is no wonder that the ladies felt an inclination to talk and linger, especially when there are taken into account the additional inducements of fresh butter, new bread, shrimps, and watercresses. Now, the ladies being together under these circumstances, it was extremely natural that the discourse should turn upon the propensity of mankind to tyrannize over the weaker sex, and the duty that developed upon the weaker sex to resist that tyranny and assert their rights and dignity. It was natural for four reasons. Firstly, because Mrs. Quilp, being a young woman and notoriously under the dominion of her husband, ought to be excited to rebel. Secondly, because Mrs. Quilp's parent was known to be laudably shrewish in her disposition and inclined to resist male authority. Thirdly, because each visitor wished to show for herself how superior she was in this respect to the generality of her sex. And fourthly, because the company, being accustomed to scandalize each other in pairs, were deprived of their usual subject of conversation now that they were all assembled in close friendship, and had consequently no better employment than to attack the common enemy. Moved by these considerations, a stout lady opened the proceedings by inquiring, with an air of great concern and sympathy, how Mr. Quilp was, whereunto Mr. Quilp's wife's mother replied sharply, "Oh! He was well enough, nothing much was ever the matter with him, and ill weeds were sure to thrive." All the ladies then sighed in concert, shook their heads gravely, and looked at Mrs. Quilp as a martyr. "Ah," said the spokeswoman, "I wish you'd give her a little of your advice, Mrs. Genuine." Mrs. Quilp had been a Miss Genuine, it should be observed. "Nobody knows better than you, ma'am, what a swim in to ourselves." "Oh, indeed, ma'am," replied Mrs. Genuine. "When my poor husband, her dear father, was alive, if he had ever ventured a cross word to me, I'd have—" The good old lady did not finish the sentence, but she twisted off the head of a shrimp with a vindictiveness which seemed to imply that the action was in some degree a substitute for words. In this light it was clearly understood by the other party, who immediately replied with great approbation, "You quite enter into my feelings, ma'am, and it's just what I do myself." "But you have no call to do it," said Mrs. Genuine. "Luckily for you, you have no more occasion to do it than I had." "No woman need have, if she was true to herself," rejoined the stout lady. "Do you hear that, Betsy?" said Mrs. Genuine, in a warning voice. "How often have I said the same words to you, and almost gone down my knees when I spoke 'em." Poor Mrs. Quilp, who had looked in a state of helplessness from one face of condolence to another, colored, smiled, and shook her head doubtfully. This was the signal for a general clamor, which, beginning in a low murmur, gradually swelled into a great noise, in which everybody spoke at once, and all said that she, being a young woman, had no right to set up her opinions against the experiences of those who knew so much better, that it was very wrong of her not to take the advice of people who had nothing at heart but her good, that it was next door to being downright ungrateful to conduct herself in that manner, that if she had no respect for herself she ought to have some for other women, all of whom she compromised by her meekness, and that if she had no respect for other women, the time would come when other women would have no respect for her, and she would be very sorry for that, they could tell her. Having dealt out these admonitions, the ladies fell to a more powerful assault than they had yet made upon the mixed tea, new bread, fresh butter, shrimps, and watercresses, and said that their vexation was so great to see her going on like that, that they could hardly bring themselves to eat a single morsel. "It's all very fine to talk," said Mrs. Quilp with much simplicity, "but I know that if I was to die tomorrow, Quilp could marry anybody he pleased now that he could, I know." There was quite a scream of indignation at this idea. Marry whom he pleased. They would like to see him dare to think of marrying any of them, they would like to see the faintest approach to such a thing. One lady, a widow, was quite certain she should stab him if he hinted at it. "Very well," said Mrs. Quilp, nodding her head, "as I said just now, it's very easy to talk, but I say again that I know that I'm sure Quilp has such a way with him when he likes, that the best looking woman here couldn't refuse him if I was dead, and she was free, and he chose to make love to her. Come." Everybody bridled up at this remark, as much as to say, "I know you mean me. Let him try, that's all." And yet for some hidden reason they were all angry with the widow, and each lady whispered in her neighbor's ear that it was very plain that said widow thought herself the person referred to, and what a puss she was. "Mother knows," said Mrs. Quilp, "that what I say is quite correct, for she often said so before we were married. Didn't you say so, mother?" This inquiry involved the respected lady in rather a delicate position, for she certainly had been an active party in making her daughter Mrs. Quilp, and, besides, it was not supporting the family credit to encourage the idea that she had married a man whom nobody else would have. On the other hand, to exaggerate the captivating qualities of her son-in-law would be to weaken the cause of revolt, in which all her energies were deeply engaged. Beset by these opposing considerations, Mrs. Jinawan admitted the powers of insinuation, but denied the right to govern, and with a timely compliment to the stout lady brought back the discussion to the point from which it had strayed.
"Oh! It's a sensible and proper thing indeed, what Mrs. George has said," exclaimed the old lady. "If women are only true to themselves. But Betsy isn't, and more's the shame and pity.
Before I'd let a man order me about as Quilp orders her," said Mrs. George, "before I'd consent to stand in awe of a man as she does of him, I'd kill myself, and write a letter first to say he did it." This remark being loudly commended and approved of, another lady, from the Minories, put in her word.
"Mr. Quilp may be a very nice man," said this lady, "and I suppose there's no doubt he is, because Mrs. Quilp says he is, and Mrs. Jinawan says he is, and they ought to know, or nobody does. But still he is not quite a what one calls a handsome man, nor quite a young man neither, which might be a little excuse for him if anything could be, whereas his wife is young, and is good-looking, and is a woman, which is the greatest thing after all." This last clause being delivered with extraordinary pathos, elicited a corresponding murmur from the hearers, stimulated by which the lady went on to remark that if such a husband was cross and unreasonable with such a wife, then,
"If he is," interposed the mother, putting down her teacup and brushing the crumbs out of her lap, preparatory to making a solemn declaration. "If he is. He is the greatest tyrant that ever lived. She daren't call her soul her own, he makes her tremble with a word and even with a look, he frightens her to death, and she hasn't the spirit to give him a word back, no, not a single word." Notwithstanding that the fact had been notorious beforehand to all the tea drinkers, and had been discussed and expatiated on at every tea drinking in the neighborhood for the last 12 months, this official communication was no sooner made than they all began to talk at once and to vie with each other in vehemence and volubility. Mrs. George remarked that people would talk, that people had often said this to her before, that Mrs. Simmons then and there present had told her so 20 times, that she had always said, "No, Henrietta Simmons, unless I see it with my own eyes and hear it with my own ears, I never will believe it." Mrs. Simmons corroborated this testimony and added strong evidence of her own. The lady from the Minories recounted a successful course of treatment under which she had placed her own husband, who, from manifesting 1 month after marriage unequivocal symptoms of the tiger, had by this means become subdued into a perfect lamb. Another lady recounted her own personal struggle and final triumph, in the course whereof she had found it necessary to call in her mother and 2 aunts, and to weep incessantly night and day for 6 weeks. A third, who in the general confusion could secure no other listener, fastened herself upon a young woman still unmarried who happened to be amongst them, and conjured her, as she valued her own peace of mind and happiness, to profit by this solemn occasion, to take example from the weakness of Mrs. Quilp, and from that time forth to direct her whole thoughts to taming and subduing the rebellious spirit of man. The noise was at its height, and half the company had elevated their voices into a perfect shriek in order to drown the voices of the other half, when Mrs. Jinawan was seen to change color and shake her forefinger stealthily, as if exhorting them to silence. Then, and not until then, Daniel Quilp himself, the cause and occasion of all this clamor, was observed to be in the room, looking on and listening with profound attention.
"Go on, ladies, go on," said Daniel. "Mrs. Quilp, pray ask the ladies to stop to supper, and have a couple of lobsters and something light and palatable."
I didn't ask them to tea, Quilp," stammered his wife. "It's quite an accident."
"So much the better, Mrs. Quilp, these accidental parties are always the pleasantest," said the dwarf, rubbing his hands so hard that he seemed to be engaged in manufacturing, of the dirt with which they were encrusted, little charges for popguns.
"What? Not going, ladies, you are not going, surely?"
His fair enemies tossed their heads slightly as they sought their respective bonnets and shawls, but left all verbal contention to Mrs. Jinawan, who, finding herself in the position of champion, made a faint struggle to sustain the character.
"And why not stop to supper, Quilp," said the old lady, "if my daughter had a mind?"
"To be sure," rejoined Daniel. "Why not? There's nothing dishonest or wrong in the supper, I hope?" said Mrs. Jinawan.
"Surely not," returned the dwarf. "Why should there be? Nor anything unwholesome, either, unless there's lobster salad or prawns, which I'm told are not good for digestion."
And you wouldn't like your wife to be attacked with that, or anything else that would make her uneasy, would you? Said Mrs. Jinawin.
Not for a score of worlds, replied the dwarf with a grin. Not even to have a score of mothers-in-law at the same time, and what a blessing that would be.
My daughter's your wife, Mr. Quilp, certainly, said the old lady with a giggle, meant for satirical and to imply that he needed to be reminded of the fact, your wedded wife.
So she is, certainly. So she is, observed the dwarf.
And she has a right to do as she likes, I hope, Quilp, said the old lady trembling, partly with anger and partly with a secret fear of her impish son-in-law.
Hope she has. He replied.
Oh. Don't you know she has? Don't you know she has, Mrs. Jinawin?
I know she ought to have, Quilp, and would have, if she was of my way of thinking.
Why aren't you of your mother's way of thinking, my dear? Said the dwarf, turning round and addressing his wife. Why don't you always imitate your mother, my dear? She's the ornament of her sex. Your father said so every day of his life.
I am sure he did.
Her father was a blessed creature, Quilp, and worthy 20,000 of some people, said Mrs. Jinawin, 20,000,000,000.
I should like to have known him, remarked the dwarf. I dare say he was a blessed creature then, but I'm sure he is now.
It was a happy release. I believe he had suffered a long time?
The old lady gave a gasp, but nothing came of it, Quill presumed, with the same malice in his eye and the same sarcastic politeness on his tongue.
You look ill, Mrs. Jinawin. I know you have been exciting yourself too much talking, perhaps, for it is your weakness. Go to bed. Do go to bed.
I shall go when I please, Quilp, and not before.
But please to do now. Do please to go now, said the dwarf. The old woman looked angrily at him, but retreated as he advanced, and falling back before him, suffered him to shut the door upon her and bolt her out among the guests, who were by this time crowding downstairs. Being left along with his wife, who sat trembling in a corner with her eyes fixed upon the ground, the little man planted himself before her, and folding his arms looked steadily at her for a long time without speaking.
Mrs. Quilp, he said at last.
Yes, Quilp, she replied meekly. Instead of pursuing the theme he had in his mind, Quilp folded his arms again, and looked at her more sternly than before, while she averted her eyes and kept them on the ground.
Mrs. Quilp.
Yes, Quilp.
If ever you listen to these beldams again, I'll bite you.
With this laconic threat, which he accompanied with a snarl that gave him the appearance of being particularly in earnest, Mr. Quilp bade her clear the teaboard away, and bring the rum. The spirit being set before him in a huge case bottle, which had originally come out of some ship's locker, he settled himself in an armchair with his large head and face squeezed up against the back, and his little legs planted on the table.
Now, Mrs. Quilp, he said, I feel in a smoking humor, and shall probably blaze away all night. But sit where you are, if you please, in case I want you.
His wife returned no other reply than the necessary yes, Quilp, and the small lord of the creation took his first cigar and mixed his first glass of grog. The sun went down and the stars peeped out, the tower turned from its own proper colors to gray and from gray to black, the room became perfectly dark and the end of the cigar a deep fiery red, but still Mr. Quilp went on smoking and drinking in the same position, and staring listlessly out of window with a dog-like smile always on his face, save when Mrs. Quilp made some involuntary movement of restlessness or fatigue, and then it expanded into a grin of delight.
Chapter 5.
Whether Mr. Quilp took any sleep by snatches of a few winks at a time, or whether he sat with his eyes wide open all night long, certain it is that he kept his cigar alight, and kindled every fresh one from the ashes of that which was nearly consumed, without requiring the assistance of a candle. Nor did the striking of the clocks, hour after hour, appear to inspire him with any sense of drowsiness or any natural desire to go to rest, but rather to increase his wakefulness, which he showed, at every such indication of the progress of the night, by a suppressed cackling in his throat, and a motion of his shoulders, like one who laughs heartily but at the same time slyly and by stealth. At length the day broke, and poor Mrs. Quilp, shivering with cold of early morning and harassed by fatigue and want of sleep, was discovered sitting patiently on her chair, raising her eyes at intervals in mute appeal to the compassion and clemency of her lord, and gently reminding him by an occasion cough that she was still unpardoned and that her penance had been of long duration. But her dwarfish spouse still smoked his cigar and drank his rum without heeding her, and it was not until the sun had some time risen, and the activity and noise of city day were rife in the street, that he deigned to recognize her presence by any word or sign. He might not have done so even then, but for certain impatient tapping at the door he seemed to denote that some pretty hard knuckles were actively engaged upon the other side.
Why, dear me? He said, looking round with a malicious grin. It's day. Open the door, sweet Mrs. Quilp. His obedient wife withdrew the bolt, and her lady mother entered. Now, Mrs. Ginawan bounced into the room with great impetuosity, for, supposing her son-in-law to be still abed, she had come to relieve her feelings by pronouncing a strong opinion upon his general conduct and character. Seeing that he was up and dressed, and that the room appeared to have been occupied ever since she quitted it on the previous evening, she stopped short, in some embarrassment. Nothing escaped the hawk's eye of the ugly little man, who, perfectly understanding what passed in the old lady's mind, turned uglier still in the fullness of his satisfaction, and bade her good morning, with a leer or triumph. "Why, Betsy," said the old woman, "you haven't been, you don't mean to say you've been a sitting up all night?" said Quilp, supplying the conclusion of the sentence. "Yes, she has." "All night?" cried Mrs. Ginawan. "Eh, all night. Is the dear old lady deaf?" said Quilp, with a smile of which a frown was part. "Who says man and wife are bad company? Ha ha! The time has flown." "You are a brute!" exclaimed Mrs. Ginawan. "Come, come," said Quilp, willfully misunderstanding her, "of course, you mustn't call her names. She's married now, you know. And though she did beguile the time and keep me from my bed, you must not be so tenderly careful of me as to be out of humor with her. Bless you for a dear old lady. Here's to your health." "I am much obliged to you," returned the old woman, testifying by a certain restlessness in her hands a vehement desire to shake her matronly fist at her son-in-law. "Oh! I'm very much obliged to you." "Grateful soul!" cried the dwarf. "Mrs. Quilp." "Yes, Quilp," said the timid sufferer. "Help your mother to get breakfast, Mrs. Quilp. I am going to the wharf this morning, the earlier the better, so be quick." Mrs. Ginawan made a faint demonstration of rebellion by sitting down in a chair near the door and folding her arms as if in a resolute determination to do nothing. But a few whispered words from her daughter, and a kind inquiry from her son-in-law whether she felt faint, with a hint that there was abundance of cold water in the next apartment, routed these symptoms effectually, and she applied herself to the prescribed preparations with sullen diligence. While they were in progress, Mr. Quilp withdrew to the adjoining room, and, turning back his coat collar, proceeded to smear his countenance with a damp towel of very unwholesome appearance, which made his complexion rather more cloudy than it was before. But, while he was thus engaged, his caution and inquisitiveness did not forsake him, for with a face as sharp and cunning as ever, he often stopped, even in this short process, and stood listening for any conversation in the next room, of which he might be the theme. "Ah!" he said after a short effort of attention, "it was not the towel over my ears, I thought it wasn't. I'm a little hunchy villain and a monster, am I, Mrs. Ginawan? Oh!" The pleasure of this discovery called up the old dog-like smile in full force. When he had quite done with it, he shook himself in a very dog-like manner, and rejoined the ladies. Mr. Quilp now walked up to front of a looking-glass, and was standing there putting on his neckerchief, when Mrs. Ginawan, happening to be behind him, could not resist the inclination she felt to shake her fist at her tyrant son-in-law. It was the gesture of an instant, but as she did so and accompanied the action with a menacing look, she met his eye in the glass, catching her in the very act. The same glance at the mirror conveyed to her the reflection of a horribly grotesque and distorted face with the tongue lolling out, and the next instant the dwarf, turning about with a perfectly bland and placid look, inquired in a tone of great affection. "How are you now, my dear old darling?" Slight and ridiculous as the incident was, it made him appear such a little fiend, and withal such a keen and knowing one, that the old woman felt too much afraid of him to utter a single word, and suffered herself to be led with extraordinary politeness to the breakfast table. Here he by no means diminished the impression he had just produced, for he ate hard eggs, shell and all, devoured gigantic prawns with the heads and tails on, chewed tobacco and watercresses at the same time and with extraordinary greediness, drank boiling tea without winking, bit his fork and spoon till they bent again, and in short performed so many horrifying and uncommon acts that the women were nearly frightened out of their wits, and began to doubt if he were really a human creature. At last, having gone through these proceedings and many others which were equally a part of his system, Mr. Quilp left them, reduced to a very obedient and humbled state, and betook himself to the riverside, where he took boat for the wharf on which he had bestowed his name. It was flood tide when Daniel Quilp sat himself down in the ferry to cross to the opposite shore. A fleet of barges were coming lazily on, some sideways, some head first, some stern first, all in a wrong-headed, dogged, obstinate way, bumping up against the larger craft, running under the bows of steamboats,
getting into every kind of nook and corner where they had no business, and being crunched on all sides like so many walnut shells, while each with its pair of long sweeps struggling and splashing in the water looked like some lumbering fish in pain. In some of the vessels at anchor all hands were busily engaged in coiling ropes, spreading out sails to dry, taking in or discharging their cargoes. In others no life was visible but two or three tarry boys, and perhaps a barking dog running to and fro upon the deck or scrambling up to look over the side and bark the louder for the view. Coming slowly on through the forests of masts was a great steamship, beating the water in short impatient strokes with her heavy paddles as though she wanted room to breathe, and advancing in her huge bulk like a sea monster among the minnows of the Thames. On either hand were long black tiers of colliers, between them vessels slowly working out of harbour with sails glistening in the sun, and creaking noise on board, re-echoed from a hundred quarters. The water and all upon it was in active motion, dancing and buoyant and bubbling up, while the old grey tower and piles of building on the shore, with many a church spire shooting up between, looked coldly on, and seemed to disdain their chafing, restless neighbour. Daniel Quilp, who was not much affected by a bright morning save in so far as it spared him the trouble of carrying an umbrella, caused himself to be put ashore hard by the wharf, and proceeded thither through a narrow lane which, partaking of the amphibious character of its frequenters, had as much water as mud in its composition, and a very liberal supply of both. Arrived at his destination, the first object that presented itself to his view was a pair of very imperfectly shod feet elevated in the air with the soles upwards, which remarkable appearance was referable to the boy, who being of an eccentric spirit and having a natural taste for tumbling, was now standing on his head and contemplating the aspect of the river under these uncommon circumstances. He was speedily brought on his heels by the sound of his master's voice, and as soon as his head was in its right position, Mr. Quilp, to speak expressively in the absence of a better verb, punched it for him. "Come, you let me alone," said the boy, parrying Quilp's hand with both his elbows alternatively. "You'll get something you won't like if you don't, and so I tell you." "You dog," snarled Quilp, "I'll beat you with an iron rod, I'll scratch you with a rusty nail, I'll pinch your eyes, if you talk to me I will." With these threats he clenched his hand again, and dexterously diving in between the elbows and catching the boy's head as it dodged from side to side, gave it three or four good hard knocks. Having now carried his point and insisted on it, he left off. "You won't do it again," said the boy, nodding his head and drawing back, with the elbows ready in case of the worst, "now." "Stand still, you dog," said Quilp. "I won't do it again, because I've done it as often as I want. Here. Take the key." "Why don't you hit one of your size?" said the boy approaching very slowly. "Where is there one of my size, you dog?" returned Quilp. "Take the key, or I'll brain you with it." Indeed he gave him a smart tap with the handle as he spoke. "Now, open the counting house." The boy sulkily complied, muttering at first, but desisting when he looked round and saw that Quilp was following him with a steady look. And here it may be remarked, that between this boy and the dwarf there existed a strange kind of mutual liking. How born or bred, and or nourished upon blows and threats on one side, and retorts and defiances on the other, is not to the purpose. Quilp would certainly suffer nobody to contract him but the boy, and the boy would assuredly not have submitted to be so knocked about by anybody but Quilp, when he had the power to run away at any time he chose. "Now," said Quilp, passing into the wooden counting house, "you mind the wharf. Stand upon your head again, and I'll cut one of your feet off." The boy made no answer, but directly Quilp had shut himself in, stood on his head before the door, then walked on his hands to the back and stood on his head there, and then to the opposite side and repeated the performance. There were indeed four sides to the counting house, but he avoided that one where the window was, deeming it probable that Quilp would be looking out of it. This was prudent, for in point of fact, the dwarf, knowing his disposition, was lying in wait at a little distance from the sash armed with a large piece of wood, which, being rough and jagged and studded in many parts with broken nails, might possibly have hurt him. It was a dirty little box, this counting house, with nothing in it but an old rickety desk and two stools, a hat peg, an ancient almanac, an inkstand with no ink, and the stump of one pen, and an eight-day clock which hadn't gone for 18 years at least, and of which the minute hand had been twisted off for a toothpick. Daniel Quilp pulled his hat over his brows, climbed onto the desk, which had a flat top, and stretching his short length upon it went to sleep with ease of an old practitioner, intending, no doubt, to compensate himself for the deprivation of last night's rest, by long and sound nap. Sound it might have been, but long it was not, for he had not been asleep a quarter of an hour when the boy opened the door and thrust in his head, which was like a bundle of badly picked oakum.
Quilp was a light sleeper and started up directly.
"Here's somebody for you," said the boy.
"Who?"
"I don't know. Ask," said Quilp, seizing the trifle of wood before mentioned and throwing it at him with such dexterity that it was well the boy disappeared before it reached the spot on which he had stood.
"Ask, you dog."
Not caring to venture within range of such missiles again, the boy discreetly sent in his stead the first cause of the interruption, who now presented herself at the door.
"What, Nelly?" cried Quilp.
"Yes," said the child, hesitating whether to enter or retreat, for the dwarf just roused, with his disheveled hair hanging all about him and a yellow handkerchief over his head, was something fearful to behold.
"It's only me, sir."
"Come in," said Quilp, without getting off the desk.
"Come in.
Stay. Just look out into the yard, and see whether there's a boy standing on his head."
"No, sir," replied Nell. "He's on his feet."
"You are sure he is?" said Quilp. "Well. Now, come in and shut the door. What's your message, Nelly?" The child handed him a letter. Mr. Quilp, without changing his position further than to turn over a little more on his side and rest his chin on his hand, proceeded to make himself acquainted with its contents. Chapter 6. Little Nell stood timidly by, with her eyes raised to the countenance of Mr. Quilp as he read the letter, plainly showing by her looks that while she entertained some fear and distrust of the little man, she was much inclined to laugh at his uncouth appearance and grotesque attitude. And yet there was visible on the part of the child a painful anxiety for his reply, and consciousness of his power to render it disagreeable or distressing, which was strongly at variance with this impulse and restrained it more effectually than she could possibly have done by any efforts of her own. That Mr. Quilp was himself perplexed, and that in no small degree, by the contents of the letter, was sufficiently obvious. Before he had got through the first two or three lines he began to open his eyes very wide and to frown most horribly. The next two or three caused him to scratch his head in an uncommonly vicious manner, and when he came to the conclusion he gave a long dismal whistle indicative of surprise and dismay. After folding and laying it down beside him, he bit the nails of all of his 10 fingers with extreme voracity, and taking it up sharply, read it again. The second perusal was to all appearance as unsatisfactory as the first, and plunged him into a profound reverie from which he awakened to another assault upon his nails and a long stare at the child, who with her eyes turned towards the ground awaited his further pleasure.
"Hello here," he said at length, in a voice, and with a suddenness, which made the child start as though a gun had been fired off at her ear.
"Nelly."
"Yes, sir."
"Do you know what's inside this letter, Nell?"
"No, sir."
"Are you sure, quite sure, quite certain, upon your soul?"
"Quite sure, sir."
"Do you wish you may die if you do know, hey?" said the dwarf.
"Indeed I don't know," returned the child.
"Well," muttered Quilp as he marked her earnest look, "I believe you.
Humphrey.
Gone already?
Gone in 24 hours.
What the devil has he done with it, that's the mystery." This reflection set him scratching his head and biting his nails once more. While he was thus employed his features gradually relaxed into what was with him a cheerful smile, but which in any other man would have been a ghastly grin of pain, and when the child looked up again she found that he was regarding her with extraordinary favor and complacency.
"You look very pretty today, Nelly, charmingly pretty. Are you tired, Nelly?"
"No, sir. I'm in a hurry to get back, for he will be anxious while I am away."
"There is no hurry, little Nell, no hurry at all," said Quilp. "How should you like to be my number two, Nelly?"
"To be what, sir?"
"My number two, Nelly, my second, my Mrs. Quilp," said the dwarf. The child looked frightened, but seemed not to understand him, which Mr. Quilp observing, hastened to make his meaning more distinctly.
"To be Mrs. Quilp the second, when Mrs. Quilp the first is dead, sweet Nell," said Quilp, wrinkling up his eyes and luring her towards him with his bent forefinger,
"to be my wife, my little cherry-cheeked, red-lipped wife. Say that Mrs. Quilp lives 5 year, or only 4. You'll be just the proper age for me.
Ha ha.
Be a good girl, Nelly, a very good girl, and see if one of these days you don't come to be Mrs. Quilp of Tower Hill."
So far from being sustained and stimulated by this delightful prospect, the child shrank from him in great agitation, and trembled violently. Mr. Quilp, either because frightening anybody afforded him a constitutional delight, or because it was pleasant to contemplate the death of Mrs. Quilp number 1, and the elevation of Mrs. Quilp number 2 to her post and title, or because he was determined from purposes of his own to be agreeable and good-humored at that particular time, only laughed and feigned to take no heed of her alarm.
You shall come with me to Tower Hill and see Mrs. Quilp, that is, directly, said the dwarf. She's very fond of you, Nell, though not so fond as I am. You shall come home with me.
I must go back indeed, said the child. He told me to return directly I had the answer.
But you haven't it, Nelly, retorted the dwarf, and won't have it, and can't have it, until I have been home, so you see that to do your errand, you must go with me. Reach me yonder hat, my dear, and we'll go directly. With that, Mr. Quilp suffered himself to roll gradually off the desk until his short legs touched the ground, when he got upon them and led the way from the counting house to the wharf outside, when the first objects that presented themselves were the boy who had stood on his head and another young gentleman of about his own stature, rolling in the mud together, locked in a tight embrace, and cuffing each other with mutual heartiness.
"It's Kit," cried Nelly, clasping her hand, "poor Kit who came with me.
Oh, pray stop them, Mr. Quilp."
"I'll stop him," cried Quilp, diving into the little counting house and returning with a thick stick, "I'll stop him. Now, my boys, fight away. I'll fight you both. I'll take both of you, both together, both together."
With which defiances the dwarf flourished his cudgel, and dancing round the combatants and treading upon them and skipping over them, in a kind of frenzy, laid about him, now on one and now on the other, in a most desperate manner, always aiming at their heads and dealing such blows as none but the veriest little savage would have inflicted. This being warmer work than they had calculated upon, speedily cooled the courage of the belligerents, who scrambled to their feet and called for quarter.
"I'll beat you to a pulp, you dogs," said Quilp, vainly endeavoring to get near either of them for a parting blow. "I'll bruise you until you're copper-colored, I'll break your faces till you haven't a profile between you, I will."
"Come, you drop that stick or it'll be worse for you," said his boy, dodging round him and watching an opportunity to rush in. "You drop that stick.
Come a little nearer, and I'll drop it on your skull, you dog," said Quilp, with gleaming eyes, "a little nearer, nearer yet."
But the boy declined the invitation until his master was apparently a little off his guard, when he darted in and seizing the weapon tried to wrest it from his grasp. Quilp, who was as strong as a lion, easily kept his hold until the boy was tugging at it with his utmost power, when he suddenly let it go and sent him reeling backwards, so that he fell violently upon his head. The success of this maneuver tickled Mr. Quilp beyond description, and he laughed and stamped upon the ground as at a most irresistible jest.
"Never mind," said the boy, nodding his head and rubbing it at the same time, "you see if ever I offer to strike anybody again because they say you're an uglier dwarf than can be seen anywheres for a penny, that's all."
"Do you mean to say, I'm not, you dog?" returned Quilp.
"No," retorted the boy.
"Then what do you fight on my wharf for, you villain?" said Quilp.
"Because he said so," replied the boy, pointing to Kit, "not because you ain't."
"Then why did he say, bald Kit, that Miss Nelly was ugly, and that she and my master was obliged to do whatever his master liked? Why did he say that?"
"He said what he did because he's a fool, and you said what you did because you're very wise and clever, almost too clever to live, unless you're very careful of yourself, Kit," said Quilp, with great suavity in his manner, but still more of quiet malice about his eyes and mouth. "Here's sixpence for you, Kit. Always speak the truth. At all times, Kit, speak the truth. Lock the counting house, you dog, and bring me the key."
The other boy, to whom this order was addressed, did as he was told, and was rewarded for his partisanship in behalf of his master, by a dexterous rap on the nose with the key, which brought the water into his eyes. Then Mr. Quilp departed with the child and Kit in a boat, and the boy revenged himself by dancing on his head at intervals on the extreme verge of the wharf, during the whole time they crossed the river. There was only Mrs. Quilp at home, and she, little expecting the return of her lord, was just composing herself for a refreshing slumber when the sound of his footsteps roused her. She had barely time to seem to be occupied in some needlework, when he entered, accompanied by the child, having left Kit downstairs.
"Here's Nelly Trent, dear Mrs. Quilp," said her husband. "A glass of wine, my dear, and a biscuit, for she has had a long walk. She'll sit with you, my soul, while I write a letter."
Mrs. Quilp looked tremblingly in her spouse's face to know what this unusual courtesy might portend, and obedient to the summons she saw in his gesture, followed him into the next room.
"Mind what I say to you," whispered Quilp. "See if you can get out of her anything about her grandfather, or what they do, or how they live, or what he tells her. I've my reasons for knowing, if I can. You women talk more freely to one another than you do to us, and you have a soft, mild way with you that'll win upon her. Do you hear?"
"Yes, Quilp."
Go then. What's the matter now?
Dear Quilp, faltered his wife. I love the child if you could do without making me deceive her.
The dwarf, muttering a terrible oath, looked round as if for some weapon with which to inflict condign punishment upon his disobedient wife. The submissive little woman hurriedly entreated him not to be angry, and promised to do as he bade her.
Do you hear me? Whispered Quilp, nipping and pinching her arm. Worm yourself into her secrets, I know you can.
I'm listening, recollect. If you're not sharp enough, I'll creak the door, and woe betide you if I have to creak it much. Go.
Mrs. Quilp departed according to order, and her amiable husband, ensconcing himself behind the partly open door, and applying his ear close to it, began to listen with a face of great craftiness and attention. Poor Mrs. Quilp was thinking, however, in what manner to begin or what kind of inquiries she could make, and it was not until the door, creaking in a very urgent manner, warned her to proceed without further consideration, that the sound of her voice was heard.
How very often you have come backwards and forwards lately to Mr. Quilp, my dear.
I have said so to grandfather, 100 times, returned Nell innocently.
And what has he said to that?
Only sighed, and dropped his head, and seemed so sad and wretched that if you could have seen him I am sure you must have cried, you could not have helped it more than I know.
How that door creaks.
It often does, returned Mrs. Quilp, with an uneasy glance towards it.
But your grandfather, he used not to be so wretched?
Oh, no, said the child eagerly, so different. We were once so happy and he so cheerful and contented. You cannot think what a sad change has fallen on us since.
I am very, very sorry, to hear you speak like this, my dear, said Mrs. Quilp.
And she spoke the truth.
Thank you, returned the child, kissing her cheek, you are always kind to me, and it is a pleasure to talk to you. I can speak to no one else about him, but poor Kit. I am very happy still, I ought to feel happier perhaps than I do, but you cannot think how it grieves me sometimes to see him alter so.
He'll alter again, Nelly, said Mrs. Quilp, and be what he was before.
Oh, if God would only let that come about, said the child with streaming eyes, but it is a long time now, since he first began to I thought I saw the door moving.
It's the wind, said Mrs. Quilp, faintly.
Began to be so thoughtful and dejected, and to forget our old way of spending the time in the long evenings, said the child. I used to read to him by the fireside, and he sat listening, and when I stopped and we began to talk, he told me about my mother, and how she once looked and spoke just like me when she was a little child. Then he used to take me on his knee, and try to make me understand that she was not lying in her grave, but had flown to a beautiful country beyond the sky where nothing died or ever grew old. We were very happy once.
Nelly, Nelly, said the poor woman, I can't bear to see one as young as you so sorrowful. Pray don't cry.
I do so very seldom, said Nell, but I have kept this to myself a long time, and I am not quite well, I think, for the tears come into my eyes and I cannot keep them back. I don't mind telling you my grief, for I know you will not tell it to anyone again.
Mrs. Quilp turned away her head and made no answer.
Then, said the child, we often walked in the fields and among the green trees, and when we came home at night, we liked it better for being tired, and said what a happy place it was. And if it was dark and rather dull, we used to say, what did it matter to us, for it only made us remember our last walk with greater pleasure, and look forward to our next one. But now we never have these walks, and though it is the same house, it is darker and much more gloomy than it used to be, indeed.
She paused here, but though the door creaked more than once, Mrs. Quilp said nothing.
Mind you don't suppose, said the child earnestly, that grandfather is less kind to me than he was. I think he loves me better every day, and is kinder and more affectionate than he was the day before. You do not know how fond he is of me.
I am sure he loves you dearly, said Mrs. Quilp.
Indeed, indeed he does, cried Nell, as dearly as I love him. But I have not told you the greatest change of all, and this you must never breathe again to anyone. He has no sleep or rest, but that which he takes by day in his easy chair, for every night and nearly all night long he is away from home.
Nelly.
Hush, said the child, laying her finger on her lip and looking round. When he comes home in the morning, which is generally just before day, I let him in. Last night he was very late, and it was quite light. I saw that his face was deadly pale, that his eyes were bloodshot, and that his legs trembled as he walked. When I had gone to bed again, I heard him groan. I got up and ran back to him, and heard him say, before he knew that I was there, that he could not bear his life much longer, and if it was not for the child, would wish to die. What shall I do? Oh!
What shall I do?
The fountains of her heart were opened. The child, overpowered by the weight of her sorrows and anxieties, by the first confidence she had ever shown, and the sympathy with which her little tale had been received, hid her face in the arms of her helpless friend, and burst into a passion of tears. In a few minutes Mr. Quilp returned, and expressed the utmost surprise to find her in this condition, which he did very naturally and with admirable effect, for that kind of acting had been rendered familiar to him by long practice, and he was quite at home in it.
"She's tired, you see, Mrs. Quilp," said the dwarf, squinting in a hideous manner to imply that his wife was to follow his lead. "It's a long way from her home to the wharf, and then she was alarmed to see a couple of young scoundrels fighting, and was timorous on the water besides. All this together has been too much for her. Poor Nell."
Mr. Quilp unintentionally adopted the very best means he could have devised for the recovery of his young visitor, by patting her on the head. Such an application from any other hand might not have produced a remarkable effect, but the child shrank so quickly from his touch and felt such an instinctive desire to get out of his reach, that she rose directly and declared herself ready to return.
"But you'd better wait, and dine with Mrs. Quilp and me," said the dwarf.
"I have been away too long, sir, already," returned Nell, drying her eyes.
"Well," said Mr. Quilp, "if you will go, you will, Nelly. Here's the note. It's only to say that I shall see him tomorrow or maybe next day, and that I couldn't do that little business for him this morning. Goodbye, Nelly. Here, you sir, take care of her, do you hear?"
Kit, who appeared at the summons, deigned to make no reply to so needless an injunction, and after staring at Quilp in a threatening manner, as if he doubted whether he might not have been the cause of Nelly's shedding tears, and felt more than half disposed to revenge the fact upon him on the mere suspicion, turned about and followed his young mistress, who had by this time taken her leave of Mrs. Quilp and departed.
"You are a keen questioner, and you, Mrs. Quilp?" said the dwarf, turning upon her as soon as they were left alone.
"What more could I do?" returned his wife mildly.
"What more could you do?" sneered Quilp. "Couldn't you have done something less? Couldn't you have done what you had to do, without appearing in your favorite part of the crocodile, you minx?"
"I am very sorry for the child, Quilp," said his wife. "Surely I've done enough. I've led her on to tell her secret she supposed we were alone, and you were by, God forgive me."
"You led her on. You did a great deal truly," said Quilp. "What did I tell you about making me creak the door? It's lucky for you that from what she let fall, I've got the clue I want, for if I hadn't, I'd have visited the failure upon you, I can tell you."
Mrs. Quilp, being fully persuaded of this, made no reply. Her husband added with some exultation, "But you may thank your fortunate stars, the same stars that made you Mrs. Quilp, you may thank them that I'm upon the old gentleman's track, and have got a new light. So let me hear no more about this matter now or at any other time, and don't get anything too nice for dinner, for I shan't be home to it."
So saying, Mr. Quilp put his hat on and took himself off, and Mrs. Quilp, who was afflicted beyond measure by the recollection of the part she had just acted, shut herself up in her chamber, and smothering her head in the bedclothes bemoaned her fault more bitterly than many less tender-hearted persons would have mourned a much greater offense, for, in the majority of cases, conscience is an elastic and very flexible article, which will bear a deal of stretching and adapt itself to a great variety of circumstances. Some people, by prudent management and leaving it off piece by piece like a flannel waistcoat in warm weather, even contrive, in time, to dispense with it altogether, but there be others who can assume the garment and throw it off at pleasure, and this, being the greatest and most convenient improvement, is the one most in vogue.
Chapter 7.
"Fred," said Mr. Swiveller, "remember the once popular melody of 'Begone Dull Care, fan the sinking flame of hilarity with the wing of friendship, and pass the rosy wine.'" Mr. Richard Swiveller's apartments were in the neighborhood of Drury Lane, and in addition to this convenience of situation had the advantage of being over a tobacconist's shop, so that he was enabled to procure a refreshing sneeze at any time by merely stepping out upon the staircase, and was saved the trouble and expense of maintaining a snuff box. It was in these apartments that Mr. Swiveller made use of the expressions above recorded for the consolation and encouragement of his desponding friend, and it may not be uninteresting or improper to remark that even these brief observations partook in a double sense of the figurative and poetical character of Mr. Swiveller's mind, as the rosy wine was in fact represented by one glass of cold gin and water, which was replenished as occasion required from a bottle and jug upon the table, and was passed from one to another, in a scarcity of tumblers which, as Mr. Swiveller's was a bachelor's establishment, may be acknowledged without a blush. By a like pleasant fiction his single chamber was always mentioned in a plural number. In its disengaged times,
The tobacconist had announced it in his window as apartments for a single gentleman, and Mr. Swiveller, following up the hint, never failed to speak of it as his rooms, his lodgings, or his chambers, conveying to his hearers a notion of indefinite space, and leaving their imaginations to wander through long suites of lofty halls, at pleasure. In this flight of fancy, Mr. Swiveller was assisted by a deceptive piece of furniture, in reality a bedstead, but in semblance a bookcase, which occupied a prominent situation in his chamber and seemed to defy suspicion and challenge inquiry. There is no doubt that by day Mr. Swiveller firmly believed this secret convenience to be a bookcase and nothing more, that he closed his eyes to the bed, resolutely denied the existence of the blankets, and spurned the bolster from his thoughts. No word of its real use, no hint of its nightly service, no allusion to its peculiar properties, had ever passed between him and his most intimate friends. Implicit faith in the deception was the first article of his creed. To be the friend of Swiveller you must reject all circumstantial evidence, all reason, observation, and experience, and repose a blind belief in the bookcase. It was his pet weakness, and he cherished it. "Fred," said Mr. Swiveller, finding that his former adjuration had been productive of no effect. "Pass the rosy." Young Trent with an impatient gesture pushed the glass towards him, and fell again in the moody attitude from which he had been unwillingly roused. "I'll give you, Fred," said his friend, stirring the mixture, "a little sentiment appropriate to the occasion. Here's may the—" "Pshaw," interposed the other. "You worry me to death with your chattering. You can be merry under any circumstances." "Why, Mr. Trent," returned Dick, "there is a proverb which talks about being merry and wise. There are some people who can be merry and can't be wise, and some who can be wise, or think they can, and can't be merry. I'm one of the first sort. If the proverb's a good un, I suppose it's better to keep to half of it than none. At all events, I'd rather be merry and not wise, than like you, neither one nor t'other." "Bah!" muttered his friend, peevishly. "With all my heart," said Mr. Swiveller. "In the polite circles I believe this sort of thing isn't usually said to a gentleman in his own apartments, but never mind that. Make yourself at home," adding to this retort an observation to the effect that his friend appeared to be rather cranky in point of temper. Richard Swiveller finished the rosy and applied himself to the composition of another glassful, in which, after tasting it with great relish, he proposed a toast to an imaginary company. "Gentlemen, I'll give you, if you please, success to the ancient family of the Swivellers, and good luck to Mr. Richard in particular." "Mr. Richard, gentlemen," said Dick with great emphasis, "who spends all his money on his friends and his bah. D for his pains. Here, here." "Dick," said the other, returning to his seat after having paced the room twice or thrice, "will you talk seriously for 2 minutes, if I show you a way to make your fortune with very little trouble?"
"You've shown me so many," returned Dick, "and nothing has come of any one of them but empty pockets." "You'll tell a different story of this one, before a very long time is over," said his companion, drawing his chair to the table. "You saw my sister Nell?"
"What about her?" returned Dick.
"She has a pretty face, has she not?"
"Why, certainly," replied Dick. "I must say for her that there's not any very strong family likeness between her and you."
"Has she a pretty face?" repeated his friend impatiently.
"Yes," said Dick, "she has a pretty face, a very pretty face. What of that?"
"I'll tell you," returned his friend. "It's very plain that the old man and I will remain at daggers drawn to the end of our lives, and that I have nothing to expect from him. You see that, I suppose?"
"A bat might see that, with the sun shining," said Dick.
"It's equally plain that the money which the old Flint Rodham first taught me to expect that I should share with her at his death, will all be hers, is it not?"
"I should say it was," replied Dick, "unless the way in which I put the case to him, made an impression.
It may have done so. It was powerful, Fred. Here is a jolly old grandfather that was strong, I thought very friendly and natural. Did it strike you in that way?"
"It didn't strike him," returned the other, "so we needn't discuss it. Now look here. Nell is nearly 14.
"Fine girl of her age, but small," observed Richard Swiveller parenthetically.
"If I am to go on, be quiet for 1 minute," returned Trent, fretting at the slight interest the other appeared to take in the conversation. "Now I'm coming to the point."
"That's right," said Dick. "The girl has strong affections, and brought up as she has been, may, at her age, be easily influenced and persuaded. If I take her in hand, I will be bound by a very little coaxing and threatening to bend her to my will. Not to beat about the bush, for the advantages of the scheme would take a week to tell, what's to prevent your marrying her?"
Richard Swiveller,
who had been looking over the rim of the Templar while his companion addressed the foregoing remarks to him with great energy and earnestness of manner, no sooner heard these words than he evinced the utmost consternation, and with difficulty ejaculated the monosyllable.
"What?
I say, what's to prevent?" repeated the other with a steadiness of manner, of the effect of which upon his companion he was well assured by long experience. "What's to prevent your marrying her?"
"And she nearly 14," cried Dick.
"I don't mean marrying her now," returned the brother angrily. "Say in 2 years' time, in 3, in 4. Does the old man look like a long liver?"
"He don't look like it," said Dick, shaking his head, "but these old people, there's no trusting them, Fred. There's an aunt of mine down in Dorsetshire that was going to die when I was 8 years old, and hasn't kept her word yet. They're so aggravating, so unprincipled, so spiteful. Unless there's apoplexy in the family, Fred, you can't calculate upon them, and even then they deceive you just as often as not."
"Look at the worst side of the question then," said Trent as steadily as before, and keeping his eyes upon his friend. "Suppose he lives."
"To be sure," said Dick. "There's the rub."
"I say," resumed his friend, "suppose he lives, and I persuaded, or if the word sounds more feasible, force Nell to a secret marriage with you. What do you think would come of that?"
"A family and an annual income of nothing, to keep him on," said Richard Swiveller after some reflection.
"I tell you," returned the other with an increased earnestness, which, whether it were real or assumed, had the same effect on his companion, "that he lives for her, that his whole energies and thoughts are bound up in her, that he would no more disinherit her for an act of disobedience than he would take me into his favor again for any act of obedience or virtue that I could possibly be guilty of. He could not do it. You or any other man with eyes in his head may see that, if he chooses."
"It seems improbable, certainly," said Dick, musing.
"It seems improbable because it is improbable," his friend returned. "If you would furnish him with an additional inducement to forgive you, let there be an irreconcilable breach, a most deadly quarrel, between you and me, let there be a pretense of such a thing, I mean, of course, and he'll do fast enough. As to Nell, constant dropping will wear away a stone, you know you may trust to me as far as she is concerned. So, whether he lives or dies, what does it come to? That you become the sole inheritor of the wealth of this rich old hunks, that you and I spend it together, and that you get into the bargain a beautiful young wife."
"I suppose there's no doubt about his being rich," said Dick.
"Doubt? Did you hear what he let fall the other day when we were there?
Doubt? What will you doubt next, Dick?"
It would be tedious to pursue the conversation through all its artful windings, or to develop the gradual approaches by which the heart of Richard Swiveller was gained. It is sufficient to know that vanity, interest, poverty, and every spendthrift consideration urged him to look upon the proposal with favor, and that where all other inducements were wanting, the habitual carelessness of his disposition stepped in and still weighed down the scale on the same side. To these impulses must be added the complete ascendancy which his friend had long been accustomed to exercise over him, an ascendancy exerted in the beginning sorely at the expense of his friend's vices, and was in 9 cases out of 10 looked upon as his designing tempter when he was indeed nothing but his thoughtless, light-headed tool. The motives on the other side were something deeper than any which Richard Swiveller entertained or understood, but these being left to their own development, require no present elucidation. The negotiation was concluded very pleasantly, and Mr. Swiveller was in the act of stating in flowery terms that he had no insurmountable objection to marrying anybody plentifully endowed with money or movables, who could be induced to take him, when he was interrupted in his observations by a knock at the door, and the consequent necessity of crying "Come in." The door was opened, but nothing came in except a soapy arm and a strong gush of tobacco. The gush of tobacco came from the shop downstairs, and the soapy arm proceeded from the body of a servant girl, who being then and there engaged in cleaning the stairs had just drawn it out of a warm pail to take in a letter, which letter she now held in her hand, proclaiming aloud with that quick perception of surnames peculiar to her class that it was from Mr. Snivelling. Dick looked rather pale and foolish when he glanced at the direction, and still more so when he came to look at the inside, observing that it was one of the inconveniences of being a lady's man, and that it was very easy to talk as they had been talking, but he had quite forgotten her.
"Her? Who?" demanded Trent.
"Sophie Wackles," said Dick.
"Who's she?"
"She's all my fancy painted her, sir, that's what she is," said Mr. Swiveller, taking a long pull at the rosy and looking gravely at his friend. "She's lovely, she's divine. You know her?"
"I remember," said his companion carelessly. "What of her?"
"Why, sir," returned Dick, "between Miss Sophia Wackles and the humble individual who has now the honor to address you, warm and tender sentiments have been engendered, sentiments of the most honorable and inspiring kind.
The goddess Diana, sir, that calls aloud for the chase, is not more particular in her behavior than Sophia Wackles, I can tell you that.
Am I to believe there's anything real in what you say? Demanded his friend, you don't mean to say that any lovemaking has been going on?
Lovemaking, yes. Promising, no, said Dick. There can be no action for breach, that's one comfort. I've never committed myself in writing, Fred.
And what's in the letter, pray?
A reminder, Fred, for tonight a small party of 20, making 200 like fantastic toes in all, supposing every lady and gentleman to have the proper compliment. I must go, if it's only to begin breaking off the affair I'll do it, don't you be afraid. I should like to know whether she left this herself. If she did, unconscious of any bar to her happiness, it's affecting, Fred.
To solve this question, Mr. Swiveller summoned a handmaid and ascertained that Miss Sophie Wackles had indeed left the letter with her own hands, and that she had come accompanied, for decorum's sake no doubt, by a younger Miss Wackles, and that on learning that Mr. Swiveller was at home and being requested to walk upstairs, she was extremely shocked and professed that she would rather die. Mr. Swiveller heard this account with a degree of admiration not altogether consistent with the project in which he had just concurred, but his friend attached very little importance to his behavior in this respect, probably because he knew that he had influence sufficient to control Richard Swiveller's proceedings in this or any other matter, whenever he deemed it necessary, for the advancement of his own purposes, to exert it.
Chapter 8. Business disposed of, Mr. Swiveller was inwardly reminded of its being nigh dinner time, and to the intent that his health might not be endangered by longer abstinence, dispatched a message to the nearest eating house requiring an immediate supply of boiled beef and greens for two. With this demand, however, the eating house, having experience of its customer, declined to comply, churlishly sending back for answer that if Mr. Swiveller stood in need of beef perhaps he would be so obliging as to come there and eat it, bringing with him, as grace before meat, the amount of a certain small account which had long been outstanding. Not at all intimidated by this rebuff, but rather sharpened in wits and appetite, Mr. Swiveller forwarded the same message to another and more distant eating house, adding to it by way of rider that the gentleman was induced to send so far, not only by the great fame and popularity its beef had acquired, but in consequence of the extreme toughness of the beef retailed at the obdurant cook's shop, which rendered it quite unfit not merely for gentlemanly food, but for any human consumption. The good effect of this politic course was demonstrated by the speedy arrival of a small pewter pyramid, curiously constructed of platters and covers, whereof the boiled beef plates formed the base, and a foaming quart pot the apex, the structure being resolved into its component parts afforded all things requisite and necessary for a hearty meal, to which Mr. Swiveller and his friend applied themselves with great keenness and enjoyment.
"May the present moment," said Dick, sticking his fork into a large carbuncular potato, "be the worst of our lives. I like the plan of sending him with a peel on, there's a charm in drawing a potato from its native element, if I may so express it, to which the rich and powerful are strangers. Ah! Man wants but little here below, nor wants that little long. How true that is! After dinner.
I hope the eating housekeeper will want but little and that he may not want that little long," returned his companion, "but I suspect you've no means of paying for this.
I shall be passing present, and I'll call," said Dick, winking his eyes significantly. "The waiter's quite helpless. The goods are gone, Fred, and there's an end of it." In point of fact, it would seem that the waiter felt this wholesome truth, for when he returned for the empty plates and dishes and was informed by Mr. Swiveller with dignified carelessness that he would call and settle when he should be passing presently, he displayed some perturbation of spirit and muttered a few remarks about payment on delivery and no trust, and other unpleasant subjects, but was fain to content himself with inquiring at what hour it was likely that the gentleman would call, in order that being presently responsible for the beef, greens, and sundries, he might take to be in the way at the time. Mr. Swiveller, after mentally calculating his engagements to a nicety, replied that he should look in it from 2 minutes before 6 and 7 minutes passed, and the man disappearing with his feeble consolation, Richard Swiveller took a greasy memorandum book from his pocket and made an entry therein.
"Is that a reminder, in case you should forget to call?" said Trent with a sneer.
"Not exactly, Fred," replied the imperturbable Richard, continuing to write with a businesslike air. "I enter in this little book the names of the streets that I can't go down while the shops are open. This dinner today closes Long Acre. I bought a pair of boots in Great Queen Street last week, and made that no throughfare to. There's only one avenue to the Strand left often now, and I shall have to stop up that tonight with a pair of gloves. The roads are closing so fast in every direction, that in a month's time, unless my aunt sends me a remittance,
I shall have to go 3 or 4 miles out of town to get over the way.
There's no fear of failing, in the end? Said Trent.
Why, I hope not, returned Mr. Swiveller, but the average number of letters it take to soften her is 6, and this time we have got as far as 8 without any effect at all. I'll write another tomorrow morning. I mean to blot it a good deal and shake some water over it out of the pepper caster to make it look penitent. I'm in such a state of mind that I hardly know what I write. Blot, if you could see me at this minute shedding tears for my past misconduct. Pepper caster, my hand trembles when I think. Blot again, if that don't produce the effect, it's all over.
By this time, Mr. Swiveller had finished his entry, and he now replaced his pencil in its little sheath and closed the book, in a perfectly grave and serious frame of mind. His friend discovered that it was time for him to fulfill some other engagement, and Richard Swiveller was accordingly left alone, in company with the rosy wine and his own meditations touching Miss Sophie Wackles.
It's rather sudden, said Dick, shaking his head with a look of infinite wisdom, and running on, as he was accustomed to do, with scraps of verse as if they were only prose in a hurry. When the heart of a man is depressed with fears, the mist is dispelled when Miss Wackles appears. She's a very nice girl. She's like the red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. There's no denying that she's also like a melody that's sweetly played in tune. It's really very sudden. Not that there's any need, on account of Fred's little sister, to turn cool directly, but it's better not to go too far. If I begin to cool at all, I must begin at once. I see that. There's the chance of an action for breach, that's another. There's the chance of no, there's no chance of that, but it's as well to be on the safe side. This undeveloped was the possibility, which Richard Swiveller sought to conceal even from himself, of his not being proof against the charms of Miss Wackles, and in some unguarded moment, by linking his fortunes to hers forever, of putting it out of his own power to further their notable scheme to which he had so readily become a party. For all these reasons, he decided to pick a quarrel with Miss Wackles without delay, and casting about for a pretext determined in favor of groundless jealousy. Having made up his mind on this important point, he circulated the glass, from his right hand to left, and back again, pretty freely, to enable him to act his part with the greater discretion, and then, after making some slight improvements in his toilet, bend his steps towards the spot hallowed by the fair object of his meditations. The spot was at Chelsea, for there Miss Sophia Wackles resided with her widowed mother and two sisters, in conjunction with whom she maintained a very small day school for young ladies of proportionate dimensions, a circumstance which was made known to the neighborhood by an oval board over the front first floor windows, whereupon appeared in circumambient flourishes the words Ladies' Seminary, and which was further published and proclaimed at intervals between the hours of 9:30 and 10 in the morning, by a straggling and solitary young lady of tender years standing on the scraper on the tips of her toes and making futile attempts to reach the knocker with a spelling book. The several duties of instruction in this establishment were thus discharged. English grammar, composition, geography, and the use of the dumbbells, by Miss Melissa Wackles, writing, arithmetic, dancing, music, and general fascination, by Miss Sophia Wackles, the art of needlework, marking, and samplery, by Miss Jane Wackles, corporal punishment, fasting, and other tortures and terrors, by Mrs. Wackles. Miss Melissa Wackles was the eldest daughter, Miss Sophie the next, and Miss Jane the youngest. Miss Melissa might have seen 35 summers or thereabouts, and verged on the autumnal. Miss Sophie was a fresh, good-humored, buxom girl of 20, and Miss Jane numbered scarcely 16 years. Mrs. Wackles was an excellent but rather venomous old lady of 80. To this ladies' seminary, then, Richard Swiveller hied, with designs obnoxious to the peace of the fair Sophia, who, arrayed in virgin white, embellished by no ornament but one blushing rose, received him on his arrival, in the midst of very elegant, not to say brilliant, preparations, such as the embellishment of the room with the little flower pots which always stood on the windowsill outside, save in windy weather when they blew into the area, the choice attire of the day scholars who were allowed to grace the festival, the unwanted curls of Miss Jane Wackles who had kept her head during the whole of the preceding day screwed up tight in a yellow playbill, and the solemn gentility and stately bearing of the old lady and her eldest daughter, which struck Mr. Swiveller as being uncommon but made no further impression upon him. The truth is, and, as there is no accounting for tastes, even a taste so strange as this may be recorded without being looked upon as a willful and malicious invention, the truth is that neither Mrs. Wackles nor her eldest daughter had at any time greatly favored the pretensions of Mr. Swiveller, being accustomed to make slight mention of him as a gay young man and to sigh and shake their heads ominously whenever his name was mentioned.
Mr. Swiveller's conduct in respect to Miss Sophie having been of that vague and dilatory kind which is usually looked upon as betokening no fixed matrimonial intentions, the young lady herself began in course of time to deem it highly desirable that it should be brought to an issue one way or other. Hence she had at last consented to play off against Richard Swiveller a stricken market gardener known to be ready with his offer on the smallest encouragement, and hence as this occasion had been specially assigned for the purpose that great anxiety on her part for Richard Swiveller's presence which had occasioned her to leave the note he has been seen to receive. "If he has any expectations at all or any means of keeping a wife well," said Mrs. Wackles to her eldest daughter, "he'll state 'em to us now or never. If he really cares about me," thought Miss Sophie, "he must tell me so, tonight." But all these sayings and doings and thinkings being unknown to Mr. Swiveller, affected him not in the least. He was debating in his mind how he could best turn jealous, and wishing that Sophie were for that occasion only far less pretty than she was, or that she were her own sister, which would have served his turn as well, when the company came, and among them the market gardener, whose name was Cheggs. But Mr. Cheggs came not alone or unsupported, for he prudently brought along with him his sister, Miss Cheggs, who making straight to Miss Sophie and taking her by both hands, and kissing her on both cheeks, hoped in an audible whisper that they had not come too early. "Too early, no," replied Miss Sophie. "Oh, my dear," rejoined Miss Cheggs in the same whisper as before, "I've been so tormented, so worried, that it's a mercy we were not here at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Alec has been in such a state of impatience to come. You'd hardly believe that he was dressed before dinner time and has been looking at the clock and teasing me ever since. It's all your fault, you naughty thing." Hereupon Miss Sophie blushed, and Mr. Cheggs, who was bashful before ladies, blushed too, and Miss Sophie's mother and sisters, to prevent Mr. Cheggs from blushing more, lavished civilities and attentions upon him, and left Richard Swiveller to take care of himself. Here was the very thing he wanted. Here was good cause, reason and foundation for pretending to be angry, but having this cause, reason and foundation which he had come expressly to seek, not expecting to find, Richard Swiveller was angry in sound earnest, and wondered what the devil Cheggs meant by his impudence. However, Mr. Swiveller had Miss Sophie's hand for the first quadrille, country dances being low, were utterly proscribed, and so gained an advantage over his rival, who sat despondingly in a corner and contemplated the glorious figure of the young lady as she moved through the mazy dance. Nor was this the only start Mr. Swiveller had of the market gardener, for determining to show the family what quality of man they trifled with, and influenced perhaps by his late libations, he performed such feats of agility and such spins and twirls as filled the company with astonishment, and in particular caused a very long gentleman who was dancing with a very short scholar, to stand quite transfixed by wonder and admiration. Even Mrs. Wackles forgot for the moment to snub three small young ladies who were inclined to be happy, and could not repress a rising thought that to have such a dancer as that in the family would be a pride indeed. At this momentous crisis, Miss Cheggs proved herself a vigorous and useful ally, for not confining herself to expressing by scornful smiles a contempt for Mr. Swiveller's accomplishments, she took every opportunity of whispering into Miss Sophie's ear expressions of condolence and sympathy on her being worried by such a ridiculous creature, declaring that she was frightened to death lest Alec should fall upon, and beat him, in the fullness of his wrath, and entreating Miss Sophie to observe how the eyes of the said Alec gleamed with love and fury, passions, it may be observed, which being too much for his eyes rushed into his nose also, and suffused it with a crimson glow. "You must dance with Miss Cheggs," said Miss Sophie to Dick Swiveller, after she had herself danced twice with Mr. Cheggs and made great show of encouraging his advances. "She's a nice girl and her brother's quite delightful."
"Quite delightful, is he?" muttered Dick. "Quite delighted too, I should say, from the manner in which he's looking this way." Here Miss Jane, previously instructed for the purpose, interposed her many curls and whispered her sister to observe how jealous Mr. Cheggs was.
"Jealous. Like his impudence," said Richard Swiveller.
"His impudence, Mr. Swiveller," said Miss Jane, tossing her head.
"Take care he don't hear you, sir, or you may be sorry for it."
"Oh, pray, Jane," said Miss Sophie.
"Nonsense," replied her sister. "Why shouldn't Mr. Cheggs be jealous if he likes?
I like that. Certainly. Mr. Cheggs has a right to be jealous as anyone else has, and perhaps he may have a better right soon if he hasn't already. You know best about that, Sophie." Though this was a concerted plot between Miss Sophie and her sister, originating in humane intentions and having for its object the inducing Mr. Swiveller to declare himself in time, it failed in its effect, for Miss Jane being one of those young ladies who are prematurely shrill and shrewish,
gave such undue importance to her part that Mr. Swiveller retired in dudgeon, resigning his mistress to Mr. Cheggs and conveying a defiance into his looks which the gentleman indignantly returned.
"Did you speak to me, sir?" said Mr. Cheggs, following him into a corner. "Have the kindness to smile, sir, in order that we may not be suspected. Did you speak to me, sir?"
Mr. Swiveller looked with a supercilious smile at Mr. Cheggs' toes, then raised his eyes from them to his ankles, from that to his shin, from that to his knee, and so on very gradually, keeping up his right leg, until he reached his waistcoat, when he raised his eyes from button to button until he reached his chin, and traveling straight up the middle of his nose came at last to his eyes, when he said abruptly, "No, sir, I didn't."
"Hem," said Mr. Cheggs, glancing over his shoulder, "have the goodness to smile again, sir. Perhaps you wish to speak to me, sir."
"No, sir, I didn't do that, either."
"Perhaps you may have nothing to say to me now, sir," said Mr. Cheggs fiercely.
At these words Richard Swiveller withdrew his eyes from Mr. Cheggs' face, and traveling down the middle of his nose and down his waistcoat and down his right leg, reached his toes again, and carefully surveyed him. This done, he crossed over, and coming up the other leg, and thence approaching by the waistcoat as before, said when had got to his eyes, "No, sir, I haven't."
"Oh, indeed, sir," said Mr. Cheggs. "I'm glad to hear it. You know where I'm to be found, I suppose, sir, in case you should have anything to say to me?"
"I can easily inquire, sir, when I want to know."
"There's nothing more we need say, I believe, sir?"
"Nothing more, sir." With that they closed the tremendous dialogue by frowning mutually. Mr. Cheggs hastened to tender his hand to Miss Sophy, and Mr. Swiveller sat himself down in a corner in a very moody state. Hard by this corner, Mrs. Wackles and Miss Wackles were seated, looking on at the dance, and unto Mrs. and Miss Wackles Mississippi Cheggs occasionally darted when her partner was occupied with his share of the figure, and made some remark or other which was gall and wormwood to Richard Swiveller's soul. Looking into the eyes of Mrs. and Miss Wackles for encouragement, and sitting very upright and uncomfortable on a couple of hard stools, were two of the day scholars, and when Miss Wackles smiled, and Mrs. Wackles smiled, the two little girls on the stools sought to curry favor by smiling likewise, in gracious acknowledgment of which attention the old lady frowned them down instantly, and said that if they dared to be guilty of such an impertinence again, they should be sent under convoy to their respective homes. This threat caused one of the young ladies, she being of a weak and trembling temperament, to shed tears, and for this offense they were both filed off immediately, with a dreadful promptitude that struck terror into the souls of all the pupils.
"I've got such news for you," said Miss Cheggs approaching once more, "Alec has been saying such things to Sophie. Upon my word, you know, it's quite serious and in earnest, that's clear."
"What's he been saying, my dear?" demanded Mrs. Wackles.
"All manner of things," replied Miss Cheggs, "you can't think how out he has been speaking."
Richard Swiveller considered it advisable to hear no more, but taking advantage of a pause in the dancing, and the approach of Mr. Cheggs to pay his court to the old lady, swaggered with an extremely careful assumption of extreme carelessness toward the door, passing on the way Miss Jane Wackles, who in all the glory of her curls was holding a flirtation, as good practice when no better was to be had, with a feeble old gentleman who lodged in the parlor. Near the door sat Miss Sophy, still fluttered and confused by the attentions of Mr. Cheggs, and by her side Richard Swiveller lingered for a moment to exchange a few parting words.
"My boat is on the shore and my bark is on the sea, but before I pass this door I will say farewell to thee," murmured Dick, looking gloomily upon her.
"Are you going?" said Miss Sophy, whose heart sank within her at the result of her stratagem, but who affected a light indifference notwithstanding.
"Am I going?" echoed Dick bitterly.
"Yes, I am."
"What then?"
"Nothing, except that it's very early," said Miss Sophy, "but you are your own master, of course."
"I would that I had been my own mistress too," said Dick, "before I had ever entertained a thought of you. Miss Wackles, I believed you true, and I was blessed in so believing, but now I mourn that e'er I knew, a girl so fair yet so deceiving."
Miss Sophy bit her lip and affected to look with great interest after Mr. Cheggs, who was quaffing lemonade in the distance.
"I came here," said Dick, rather oblivious of the purpose with which he had really come, "with my bosom expanded, my heart dilated, and my sentiments of a corresponding description. I go away with feelings that may be conceived but cannot be described, feeling within myself that desolating truth that my best affections have experienced this night a stifler."
"I am sure I don't know what you mean, Mr. Swiveller," said Miss Sophy with downcast eyes. "I'm very sorry if—"
"Sorry, ma'am," said Dick,
sorry in the possession of a Cheggs. But I wish you a very good night, concluding with this slight remark, that there is a young lady growing up at this present moment for me, who has not only great personal attractions but great wealth, and who has requested her next of kin to propose for my hand, which, having a regard for some members of her family, I have consented to promise. It's a gratifying circumstance which you'll be glad to hear, that a young and lovely girl is growing into a woman expressly on my account, and is now saving up for me. I thought I'd mention it. I have now merely to apologize for trespassing so long upon your attention. Good night. There is one good thing springs out of all this, said Richard Swiveller to himself when he had reached home and was hanging over the candle with the extinguisher in his hand, which is, that I now go heart and soul, neck and heels, with Fred and all his scheme about little Nelly, and right glad he'll be to find me so strong upon it. He shall know all about that tomorrow, and in the meantime, as it's rather late, I'll try and get a wink of the bommie. The bommie came almost as soon as it was courted. In a very few minutes Mr. Swiveller was fast asleep, dreaming that he had married Nelly Trent and come into the property, and that his first act of power was to lay waste the market garden of Mr. Cheggs and turn it into a brickfield. Chapter 9. The child, in her confidence with Mrs. Quilp, had but feebly described the sadness and sorrow of her thoughts, or the heaviness of the cloud which overhung her home, and cast dark shadows on its hearth. Besides that it was very difficult to impart to any person not intimately acquainted with the life she led, an adequate sense of its gloom and loneliness, a constant fear of in some way committing or injuring the old man to whom she was so tenderly attached, had restrained her, even in the midst of her heart's overflowing, and made her timid of allusion to the main cause of her anxiety and distress. For, it was not the monotonous days uncheckered by variety and uncheered by pleasant companionship, it was not the dark dreary evenings or the long solitary nights, it was not the absence of every slight and easy pleasure for which young hearts beat high, or the knowing nothing of childhood but its weakness and its easily wounded spirit, that had wrung such tears from Nell. To see the old man struck down beneath the pressure of some hidden grief, to mark his wavering and unsettled state, to be agitated at times with a dreadful fear that his mind was wandering, and to trace in his words and looks the dawning of despondent madness, to watch and wait and listen for confirmation of these things day after day, and to feel and know that, come what might, they were alone in the world with no one to help or advise or care about them. These were causes of depression and anxiety that might have sat heavily on an older breast with many influences at work to cheer and gladden it, but how heavily on the mind of a young child to whom they were ever present, and who was constantly surrounded by all that could keep such thoughts in restless action. And yet, to the old man's vision, Nell was still the same. When he could, for a moment, disengage his mind from the phantom that haunted and brooded on it always, there was his young companion with the same smile for him, the same earnest words, the same merry laugh, the same love and care that, sinking deep into his soul, seemed to have been present to him through his whole life. And so he went on, content to read the book of her heart from the page first presented to him, little dreaming of the story that lay hidden in its other leaves, and murmuring within himself that at least the child was happy. She had been once. She had gone singing through the dim rooms, and moving with gay and lightsome step among their dusty treasures, making them older by her young life, and sterner and more grim by her gay and cheerful presence. But, now, the chambers were cold and gloomy, and when she left her own little room to while away the tedious hours, and sat in one of them, she was still and motionless as their inanimate occupants, and had no heart to startle the echoes hoarse from their long silence with her voice. In one of these rooms, was a window looking into the street, where the child sat, many and many a long evening, and often far into the night, alone and thoughtful. None are so anxious as those who watch and wait. At these times, mournful fancies came flocking on her mind, in crowds. She would take her station here, at dusk, and watch the people as they passed up and down the street, or appeared at the windows of the opposite houses, wondering whether those rooms were as lonesome as that in which she sat, and whether those people felt it company to see her sitting there, as she did only to see them look out and draw in their heads again. There was a crooked stack of chimneys on one of the roofs, in which, by often looking at them, she had fancied ugly faces that were frowning over at her and trying to peer into the room, and she felt glad when it grew too dark to make them out, though she was sorry too, when the man came to light the lamps in the street, for it made it late, and very dull inside. Then, she would draw in her head to look round the room and see that everything was in its place and hadn't moved, and looking out into the street again, would perhaps see a man passing with a coffin on his back, and two or three others silently following him to a house where somebody lay dead, which made her shudder and think of such things until they suggested afresh the old man's altered face and manner, and a new train of fears and speculations. If he were to die if sudden illness had happened to him, and he were never to come home again, alive if,
One night, he should come home, and kiss and bless her as usual, and after she had gone to bed and had fallen asleep and was perhaps dreaming pleasantly, and smiling in her sleep, he should kill himself and his blood come creeping, creeping, on the ground to her own bedroom door. These thoughts were too terrible to dwell upon, and again she would have recourse to the street, now trodden by fewer feet, and darker and more silent than before. The shops were closing fast, and lights began to shine from the upper windows, as the neighbors went to bed. By degrees, these dwindled away and disappeared or were replaced, here and there, by a feeble rush candle which was to burn all night. Still, there was one late shop at no great distance which sent forth a ruddy glare upon the pavement even yet, and looked bright and companionable. But, in a little time, this closed, the light was extinguished, and all was gloomy and quiet, except when some stray footsteps sounded on the pavement, or a neighbor, out later than his wont, knocked lustily at his house door to rouse the sleeping inmates. When the night had worn away thus far, and seldom now until it had, the child would close the window, and steal softly downstairs, thinking as she went that if one of those hideous faces below, which often mingled with her dreams, were to meet her by the way, rendering itself visible by some strange light of its own, how terrified she would be. But these fears vanished before a well-trimmed lamp and the familiar aspect of her own room. After praying fervently, and with many bursting tears, for the old man, and the restoration of his peace of mind and the happiness they had once enjoyed, she would lay her head upon the pillow and sob herself to sleep, often starting up again, before the daylight came, to listen for the bell and respond to the imaginary summons which had roused her from her slumber. One night, the third after Nellie's interview with Mrs. Quilp, the old man, who had been weak and ill all day, said he should not leave home. The child's eyes sparkled at the intelligence, but her joy subsided when they reverted to his worn and sickly face. 2 days, he said, two whole, clear, days have passed, and there is no reply. What did he tell thee, Nell? Exactly what I told you, dear grandfather, indeed. True, said the old man, faintly. Yes. But tell me again, Nell. My head fails me. What was it that he told thee? Nothing more than that he would see me tomorrow or next day? That was in the note. Nothing more, said the child. Shall I go to him again tomorrow, dear grandfather? Very early? I will be there and back, before breakfast. The old man shook his head, and sighing mournfully, drew her towards him. It would be of no use, my dear, no earthly use. But if he deserts me, Nell, at this moment if he deserts me now, when I should, with his assistance, be recompensed for all the time and money I have lost, and all the agony of mind I have undergone, which makes me what you see, I am ruined, and worse, far worse than that have ruined thee, for whom I ventured all. If we are beggars. What if we are? Said the child boldly. Let us be beggars, and be happy. Beggars and happy. Said the old man. Poor child. Dear grandfather, cried the girl with an energy which shone in her flushed face, trembling voice, and impassioned gesture, I am not a child in that I think, but even if I am, oh hear me pray that we may beg, or work in open roads or fields, to earn a scanty living, rather than live as we do now. Nelly, said the old man. Yes, yes, rather than live as we do now, the child repeated, more earnestly than before. If you are sorrowful, let me know why and be sorrowful too. If you waste away and are paler and weaker every day, let me be your nurse and try to comfort you. If you are poor, let us be poor together, but let me be with you, do let me be with you, do not let me see such change and not know why, or I shall break my heart and die. Dear grandfather, let us leave this sad place tomorrow, and beg our way from door to door. The old man covered his face with his hands, and hid it in the pillow of the couch on which he lay. Let us be beggars, said the child passing an arm round his neck. I have no fear but we shall have enough, I am sure we shall. Let us walk through country places, and sleep in fields and under trees, and never think of money again, or anything that can make you sad, but rest at nights, and have the sun and wind upon our faces in the day, and thank God together. Let us never set foot in dark rooms or melancholy houses, any more, but wander up and down wherever we like to go, and when you are tired, you shall stop to rest in the pleasantest place that we can find, and I will go and beg for both. The child's voice was lost in sobs as she dropped upon the old man's neck, nor did she weep alone. These were not words for other ears, nor was it a scene for other eyes. And yet other ears and eyes were there and greedily taking in all that passed, and moreover they were the ears and eyes of no less a person than Mr. Daniel Quilp, who, having entered unseen when the child first placed herself at the old man's side, refrained actuated, no doubt, by motives of the purest delicacy from interrupting the conversation, and stood looking on with his accustomed grin. Standing, however, being a tiresome attitude to a gentleman already fatigued with walking, and the dwarf being one of that kind of persons who usually make themselves at home, he soon cast his eyes upon a chair, into which he skipped with uncommon agility, and perching himself on the back with his feet upon the seat, was thus enabled to look on and listen with greater comfort to himself, besides gratifying at the same time that taste for doing something fantastic and monkey-like, which on all occasions had strong possession of him. Here, then, he sat, one leg cocked carelessly over the other, his chin resting on the palm of his hand, his head turned a little on one side, and his ugly features twisted into a complacent grimace. And in this position the old man, happening in course of time to look that way, at length chanced to see him, to his unbounded astonishment. The child uttered a suppressed shriek on beholding this agreeable figure. In their first surprise both she and the old man, not knowing what to say, and half doubting its reality, looked shrinkingly at it. Not at all disconcerted by this reception, Daniel Quilp preserved the same attitude, merely nodding twice or thrice with great condescension. At length, the old man pronounced his name, and inquired how he came there. "Through the door," said Quilp, pointing over his shoulder with his thumb. "I'm not quite small enough to get through keyholes. I wish I was. I want to have some talk with you, particularly, and in private. With nobody present, neighbor. Goodbye, little Nelly." Nell looked at the old man, who nodded to her to retire, and kissed her cheek. "Ah," said the dwarf, smacking his lips, "what a nice kiss that was just upon the rosy part. What a capital kiss." Nell was none the slower in going away, for this remark. Quilp looked after her with an admiring leer, and when she had closed the door, fell to complimenting the old man upon her charms. "Such a fresh, blooming, modest little bud, neighbor," said Quilp, nursing his short leg, and making his eyes twinkle very much, "such a chubby, rosy, cozy, little Nell." The old man answered by a forced smile, and was plainly struggling with a feeling of the keenest and most exquisite impatience. It was not lost upon Quilp, who delighted in torturing him, or indeed anybody else, when he could. "She's so," said Quilp, speaking very slowly, and feigning to be quite absorbed in the subject, "so small, so compact, so beautifully modeled, so fair, with such blue veins and such a transparent skin, and such little feet, and such winning ways, but bless me, you're nervous. Why, neighbor, what's the matter? I swear to you," continued the dwarf, dismounting from the chair and sitting down in it, with a careful slowness of gesture very different from the rapidity with which he had sprung up unheard, "I swear to you that I had no idea old blood ran so fast or kept so warm. I thought it was sluggish in its course, and cool, quite cool. I am pretty sure it ought to be. Yours must be out of order, neighbor." "I believe it is," groaned the old man, clasping his head with both hands. "There is burning fever here, and something now and then to which I fear to give a name." The dwarf said never a word, but watched his companion as he paced restlessly up and down the room, and presently returned to his seat. Here he remained, with his head bowed upon his breast for some time, and then suddenly raising it, said, "Once, and once for all, have you brought me any money?"
"No,"
returned Quilp. "Then," said the old man, clenching his hands desperately, and looking upwards, "the child and I are lost." "Neighbor," said Quilp, glancing sternly at him, and beating his hand twice or thrice upon the table to attract his wandering attention, "let me be plain with you, and play a fairer game than when you held all the cards, and I saw but the backs and nothing more. You have no secret from me now." The old man looked up, trembling. "You are surprised," said Quilp. "Well, perhaps that's natural. You have no secret from me now, I say, no, not one. For now, I know, that all those sums of money, that all those loans, advances, and supplies that you have had from me, have found their way to, shall I say the word?"
"Aye,"
replied the old man, "say it, if you will."
"To the gaming table," rejoined Quilp, "your nightly hunt. This was the precious scheme to make your fortune, was it? This was the secret certain source of wealth in which I was to have sunk my money, if I had been the fool you took me for? This was your inexhaustible mine of gold, your El Dorado, eh?"
"Yes," cried the old man, turning upon him with gleaming eyes, "it was. It is. It will be, till I die."
"That I should have been blinded," said Quilp, looking contemptuously at him, "by a mere shallow gambler."
"I am no gambler," cried the old man fiercely. "I call heaven to witness that I never played for gain of mine, or love of play, that at every piece I staked,
I whispered to myself that orphan's name and called on heaven to bless the venture, which it never did. Whom did it prosper? Who were those with whom I played? Men who lived by plunder, profligacy, and riot, squandering their gold in doing ill, and propagating vice and evil. My winnings would have been from them, my winnings would have been bestowed to the last farthing on a young sinless child whose life they would have sweetened and made happy. What would they have contracted? The means of corruption, wretchedness, and misery. Who would not have hoped in such a cause? Tell me that. Who would not have hoped as I did? When did you first begin this mad career? Asked Quilp, his taunting inclination subdued, for a moment, by the old man's grief and wildness. When did I first begin? He rejoined, passing his hand across his brow. When was it, that I first began? When should it be, but when I began to think how little I had saved, how long a time it took to save it all, how short a time I might have at my age to live, and how she would be left to the rough mercies of the world, with barely enough to keep her from the sorrows that wait on poverty, then it was that I began to think about it. After you first came to me to get your precious grandson packed off to sea? Said Quilp. Shortly after that, replied the old man. I thought of it a long time, and had it in my sleep for months. Then I began. I found no pleasure in it, I expected none. What has it ever brought me but anxious days and sleepless nights, but loss of health and peace of mind, and gain of feebleness and sorrow? You lost what money you had laid by, first, and then came to me. While I thought you were making your fortune, as you said you were making yourself a beggar, eh? Dear me. And so it comes to pass that I hold every security you could scrape together, and a bill of sale upon the stock and property, said Quilp, standing up and looking about him, as if to assure himself that none of it had been taken away. But did you never win? Never. Groaned the old man. Never won back my loss. I thought, sneered the dwarf, that if a man played long enough he was sure to win at last, or, at the worst, not to come off a loser. And so he is, cried the old man, suddenly rousing himself from his state of despondency, and lashed into the most violent excitement. So he is, I have felt that from the first, I have always known it, I've seen it, I never felt it half so strongly as I feel it now. Quilp, I have dreamed, three nights, of winning the same large sum, I never could dream that dream before, though I have often tried. Do not desert me, now I have this chance. I have no resource but you, give me some help, let me try this one last hope. The dwarf shrugged his shoulders and shook his head. See, Quilp, good tender-hearted Quilp, said the old man, drawing some scraps of paper from his pocket with a trembling hand, and clasping the dwarf's arm, only see here. Look at these figures, the result of long calculation, and painful and hard experience. I must win. I only want a little help once more, a few pounds, but 20 pounds, dear Quilp. The last advance was 70, said the dwarf, and it went in one night. I know it did, answered the old man, but that was the very worst fortune of all, and the time had not come then. Quilp, consider, consider, the old man cried, trembling so much the while, that the papers in his hand fluttered as if they were shaken by the wind, that orphan child. If I were alone, I could die with gladness, perhaps even anticipate the doom which is dealt out so unequally, coming, as it does, on the proud and happy in their strength, and shunning the needy and afflicted, and all who courted in their despair. But what I have done, has been for her. Help me for her sake, I implore you, not for mine, for hers. I'm sorry I've got an appointment in the city, said Quilp, looking at his watch with perfect self-possession, or I should have been very glad to have spent half an hour with you while you composed yourself, very glad. Nay, Quilp, good Quilp, gasped the old man, catching at his skirts, you and I have talked together, more than once, of her poor mother's story. The fear of her coming to poverty has perhaps been bred in me by that. Do not be hard upon me, but take that into account. You are a great gainer by me. Oh, spare me the money for this one last hope. I couldn't do it really, said Quilp with unusual politeness, though I tell you what, and this is a circumstance worth bearing in mind as showing how the sharpest among us may be taken, and sometimes I was so deceived by the penurious way in which you lived, alone with Nelly. All done to save money for tempting fortune, and to make her triumph greater, cried the old man. Yes, yes, I understand that now, said Quilp, but I was going to say, I was so deceived by that, your miserly way, the reputation you had among those who knew you of being rich, and your repeated assurances that you would make of my advances treble and quadruple the interest you paid me, that I'd have advanced you, even now, what you want, on your simple note of hand,
if I hadn't unexpectedly become acquainted with your secret way of life.
Who is it, retorted the old man desperately, that, notwithstanding all my caution, told you?
Come. Let me know the name the person.
The crafty dwarf, bethinking himself that his giving up the child would lead to the disclosure of the artifice he had employed, which, as nothing was to be gained by it, it was well to conceal, stopped short in his answer and said, Now, who do you think?
It was Kit, it must have been the boy, he played the spy, and you tampered with him? Said the old man.
How came you to think of him? Said the dwarf in a tone of great commiseration.
Yes, it was Kit. Poor Kit.
So saying, he nodded in a friendly manner, and took his leave, stopping when he had passed the outer door a little distance, and grinning with extraordinary delight.
Poor Kit! Muttered Quilp. I think it was Kit who said I was an uglier dwarf than could be seen anywhere for a penny, wasn't it?
Ha ha ha! Poor Kit!
And with that he went his way, still chuckling as he went.
Chapter 10. Daniel Quilp neither entered nor left the old man's house, unobserved. In the shadow of an archway nearly opposite, leading to one of the many passages which diverged from the main street, there lingered one, who, having taken up his position when the twilight first came on, still maintained it with undiminished patience, and leaning against the wall with the manner of a person who had a long time to wait, and being well used to it was quite resigned, scarcely changed his attitude for the hour together. This patient lounger attracted little attention from any of those who passed, and bestowed as little upon them. His eyes were constantly directed towards one object, the window at which the child was accustomed to sit. If he withdrew them for a moment, it was only to glance at a clock in some neighboring shop, and then to strain his sight once more in the old quarter with increased earnestness and attention. It had been remarked that this personage evinced no wariness in his place of concealment, nor did he, long as his waiting was. But as the time went on, he manifested some anxiety and surprise, glancing at the clock more frequently and at the window less hopefully than before. At length, the clock was hidden from his sight by some envious shutters, then the church steeples proclaimed 11 at night, then the quarter passed, and then the conviction seemed to obtrude itself on his mind that it was no use tarrying there any longer. That the conviction was an unwelcome one, and that he was by no means willing to yield to it, was apparent from his reluctance to quit the spot, from the tardy steps with which he often left it, still looking over his shoulder at the same window, and from the precipitation with which he has often returned, when a fancied noise or the changing and imperfect light induced him to suppose it had been softly raised. At length, he gave the matter up, as hopeless for that night, and suddenly breaking into a run as though to force himself away, scampered off at his utmost speed, nor once ventured to look behind him lest he should be tempted back again. Without relaxing his pace, or stopping to take breath, this mysterious individual dashed on through a great many alleys and narrow ways until he at length arrived in a square paved court, when he subsided into a walk, and making for a small house from the window of which a light was shining, lifted the latch of the door and passed in.
"Bless us!" cried a woman turning sharply round, "who's that?"
"Oh! It's you, Kit."
"Yes, mother, it's me."
"Why, how tired you look, my dear."
"Old master ain't gone out tonight," said Kit, "and so she hasn't been at the window at all." With which words, he sat down by the fire and looked very mournful and discontented. The room in which Kit sat himself down, in this condition, was an extremely poor and homely place, but with that air of comfort about it, nevertheless, which or the spot must be a wretched one indeed cleanliness and order can always impart in some degree. Late as the Dutch clock showed it to be, the poor woman was still hard at work at an ironing table, a young child lay sleeping in a cradle near the fire, and another, a sturdy boy of 2 or 3 years old, very wide awake, with a very tight nightcap on his head, and a nightgown very much too small for him on his body, was sitting bolt upright in a clothes basket, staring over the rim with his great round eyes, and looking as if he had thoroughly made up his mind never to go to sleep any more, which, as he had already declined to take his natural rest and had been brought out of bed in consequence, opened a cheerful prospect for his relations and friends. It was rather a queer-looking family, Kit, his mother, and the children, being all strongly alike. Kit was disposed to be out of temper, as the best of us are too often, but he looked at the youngest child who was sleeping soundly, and from him to his other brother in the clothes basket, and from him to their mother, who had been at work without complaint since morning, and thought it would be a better and kinder thing to be good-humored. So he rocked the cradle with his foot, made a face at the rebel in the clothes basket, which put him in high good humor directly, and stoutly determined to be talkative and make himself agreeable.
"Ah, mother," said Kit, taking out his clasp knife,
and falling upon a great piece of bread and meat which she had it ready for him, hours before, "What a one you are! There aren't many such as you, I know. I hope there are many a great deal better, Kit," said Mrs. Nubbles, "and that there are, or ought to be, according to what the parson at chapel says."
"Much he knows about it," returned Kit contemptuously. "Wait till he's a widder and works like you do, and gets as little, and does as much, and keeps his spirit up the same, and then I'll ask him what's o'clock and trust him for being right to half a second."
"Well," said Mrs. Nubbles, evading the point, "your beer's down there by the fender, Kit."
"I see," replied her son, taking up the porter pot, "my love to you, mother. And the parson's health too if you like. I don't bear him any malice, not I."
"Did you tell me, just now, that your master hadn't gone out tonight?" inquired Mrs. Nubbles.
"Yes," said Kit, "worse luck."
"You should say better luck, I think," returned his mother, "because Miss Nelly won't have been left alone."
"Ah," said Kit, "I forgot that. I said worse luck, because I've been watching ever since 8 o'clock, and seen nothing of her."
"I wonder what she'd say," cried his mother, stopping in her work and looking round, "if she knew that every night, when she poor thing is sitting alone at that window, you are watching in the open street for fear any harm should come to her, and that you never leave the place or come home to your bed though you're ever so tired, till such time as you think she's safe in hers."
"Never mind what she'd say," replied Kit, with something like a blush on his uncouth face, "she'll never know nothing, and consequently, she'll never say nothing."
Mrs. Nubbles ironed away in silence for a minute or two, and coming to the fireplace for another iron, glanced stealthily at Kit while she rubbed it on a board and dusted it with a duster, but said nothing until she had returned to her table again, when, holding the iron at an alarmingly short distance from her cheek, to test its temperature, and looking round with a smile, she observed,
"I know what some people would say, Kit."
"Nonsense," interposed Kit with a perfect apprehension of what was to follow.
"No, but they would indeed. Some people would say that you'd fallen in love with her, I know they would."
To this, Kit only replied by bashfully bidding his mother get out, and forming sundry strange figures with his legs and arms, accompanied by sympathetic contortions of his face. Not deriving from these means the relief which he sought, he bit off an immense mouthful from the bread and meat, and took a quick drink of the porter, by which artificial aids he choked himself and effected a diversion of the subject.
"Speaking seriously though, Kit," said his mother, taking up the theme afresh, after a time, "for of course I was only in joke just now, it's very good and thoughtful, and like you, to do this, and never let anybody know it, though some day I hope she may come to know it, for I'm sure she would be very grateful to you and feel it very much. It's a cruel thing to keep the dear child shut up there. I don't wonder that the old gentleman wants to keep it from you."
"He don't think it's cruel, bless you," said Kit, "and don't mean it to be so, or he wouldn't do it I do consider, mother, that he wouldn't do it for all the gold and silver in the world.
No, no, that he wouldn't. I know him better than that."
"Then what does he do it for, and why does he keep it so close from you?" said Mrs. Nubbles.
"That I don't know," returned her son. "If he hadn't tried to keep it so close though, I should never have found it out, for it was his getting me away at night and sending me off so much earlier than he used to, that first made me curious to know what was going on. Hark! What's that?"
"It's only somebody outside.
It's somebody crossing over here," said Kit, standing up to listen, "and coming very fast too. He can't have gone out after I left, and the house caught fire, mother."
The boy stood, for a moment, really bereft, by the apprehension he had conjured up, of the power to move. The footsteps drew nearer, the door was opened with a hasty hand, and the child herself, pale and breathless, and hastily wrapped in a few disordered garments, hurried into the room.
"Miss Nelly! What is the matter?" cried mother and son together.
"I must not stay a moment," she returned. "Grandfather has been taken very ill. I found him in a fit upon the floor."
"I'll run for a doctor," said Kit, seizing his brimless hat. "I'll be there directly, I'll—"
"No, no," cried Nell, "there is one there, you're not wanted, you must never come near us anymore."
"What?" roared Kit.
"Never again," said the child. "Don't ask me why, for I don't know. Pray don't ask me why, pray don't be sorry, pray don't be vexed with me. I have nothing to do with it indeed."
Kit looked at her with his eyes stretched wide, and opened and shut his mouth a great many times, but couldn't get out one word.
"He complains and raves of you," said the child. "I don't know what you have done, but I hope it's nothing very bad."
"I done," roared Kit.
"He cried that you're the cause of all his misery,
returned the child with tearful eyes. He screamed and called for you. They say you must not come near him or he will die. You must not return to us anymore. I came to tell you. I thought it would be better that I should come than somebody quite strange.
Oh, Kit, what have you done? You, in whom I trusted so much, and who were almost the only friend I had.
The unfortunate Kit looked at his young mistress harder and harder, and with eyes growing wider and wider, but was perfectly motionless and silent.
I have brought his money for the week, said the child, looking to the woman and laying it on the table, and a little more, for he was always good and kind to me. I hope he will be sorry and do well somewhere else and not take this to heart too much. It grieves me very much to part with him like this, but there is no help. It must be done. Good night.
With the tears streaming down her face, and her slight figure trembling with the agitation of the scene she had left, the shock she had received, the errand she had just discharged, and a thousand painful and affectionate feelings, the child hastened to the door, and disappeared as rapidly as she had come. The poor woman, who had no cause to doubt her son, but every reason for relying on his honesty and truth, was staggered, notwithstanding, by his not having advanced one word in his defense. Visions of gallantry, knavery, robbery, and of the nightly absences from home for which he had accounted so strangely, having been occasioned by some unlawful pursuit, flocked into her brain and rendered her afraid to question him. She rocked herself upon a chair, wringing her hands and weeping bitterly, but Kit made no attempt to comfort her and remained quite bewildered. The baby in the cradle woke up and cried. The boy in the clothes basket fell over on his back with the basket upon him, and was seen no more. The mother wept louder yet and rocked faster, but Kit, insensible to all the din and tumult, remained in a state of utter stupefaction. 1 Chapter 11. Quiet and solitude were destined to hold uninterrupted rule no longer, beneath the roof that sheltered the child. Next morning, the old man was in a raging fever accompanied with delirium, and sinking under the influence of this disorder he lay for many weeks in imminent peril of his life. There was watching enough, now, but it was the watching of strangers who made a greedy trade of it, and who, in the intervals in their attendance upon the sick man, huddled together with a ghastly good fellowship, and ate and drank and made merry, for disease and death were their ordinary household gods. Yet, in all the hurry and crowding of such a time, the child was more alone than she had ever been before, alone in spirit, alone in her devotion to him who was wasting away upon his burning bed, alone in her unfeigned sorrow, and her unpurchased sympathy. Day after day, and night after night, found her still by the pillow of the unconscious sufferer, still anticipating his every want, still listening to those repetitions of her name and those anxieties and cares for her, which were ever uppermost among his feverish wanderings. The house was no longer theirs. Even the sick chamber seemed to be retained, on the uncertain tenure of Mr. Quilp's favor. The old man's illness had not lasted many days when he took formal possession of the premises and all upon them, in virtue of certain legal powers to that effect, which few understood and none presumed to call in question. This important step secured, with the assistance of a man of law whom he brought with him for the purpose, the dwarf proceeded to establish himself and his coadjutor in the house, as an assertion of his claim against all comers, and then set about making his quarters comfortable, after his own fashion. To this end, Mr. Quilp encamped in the back parlor, having first put an effectual stop to any further business by shutting up the shop. Having looked out, from among the old furniture, the handsomest and most commodious chair he could possibly find, which he reserved for his own use, and an especially hideous and uncomfortable one, which he considerately appropriated to the accommodation of his friend, he caused them to be carried into this room, and took up his position in great state. The apartment was very far removed from the old man's chamber, but Mr. Quilp deemed it prudent, as a precaution against infection from fever, and a means of wholesome fumigation, not only to smoke, himself, without cessation, but to insist upon it that his legal friend did the like. Moreover, he sent an express to the wharf for the tumbling boy, who arriving with all dispatch was enjoined to sit himself down in another chair just inside the door, continually to smoke a great pipe which the dwarf had provided for the purpose, and to take it from his lips under any pretense whatever, were it only for 1 minute at a time, if he dared. These arrangements completed, Mr. Quilp looked round him with chuckling satisfaction, and remarked that he called that comfort. The legal gentleman, whose melodious name was Brass, might have called it comfort also but for two drawbacks. One was, that he could by no exertion sit easy in his chair, the seat of which was very hard, angular, slippery, and sloping. The other, that tobacco smoke always caused him great internal discomposure and annoyance. But as he was quite a creature of Mr. Quilp's and had a thousand reasons for conciliating his good opinion, he tried to smile, and nodded his acquiescence with the best grace he could assume. This Brass was an attorney of no very good repute, from Bevis Marks in the City of London. He was a tall, meager man, with a nose like a wen, a protruding forehead, retreating eyes, and hair of a deep red. He wore a long black surtout reaching nearly to his ankles, short black trousers, high shoes, and cotton stockings of a bluish gray. He had a cringing manner, but a very harsh voice, and his blandest smiles were so extremely forbidding, that to have had his company under the least repulsive circumstances, one would have wished him to be out of temper that he might only scowl. Quilp looked at his legal adviser, and seeing that he was winking very much in the anguish of his pipe, that he sometimes shuddered when he happened to inhale its full flavor, and that he constantly fanned the smoke from him, was quite overjoyed and rubbed his hands with glee. "Smoke away, you dog," said Quilp, turning to the boy, "fill your pipe again and smoke it fast, down to the last whiff, or I'll put the sealing waxed end of it in the fire and rub it red hot upon your tongue." Luckily the boy was case-hardened, and would have smoked a small lime kiln if anybody had treated him with it. Wherefore, he only muttered a brief defiance of his master, and did as he was ordered. "Is it good, Brass? Is it nice? Is it fragrant? Do you feel like the Grand Turk?" said Quilp. Mr. Brass thought that if he did, the Grand Turk's feelings were by no means to be envied, but he said it was famous, and he had no doubt he felt very like that potentate. "This is the way to keep off fever," said Quilp, "this is the way to keep off every calamity of life. We'll never leave off, all the time we stop here smoke away, you dog, or you shall swallow the pipe." "Shall we stop here long, Mr. Quilp?" inquired his legal friend, when the dwarf had given his boy this gentle admonition. "We must stop, I suppose, till the old gentleman upstairs is dead," returned Quilp. "He he he," laughed Mr. Brass, "oh! Very good." "Smoke away," cried Quilp. "Never stop. You can talk as you smoke. Don't lose time." "He he he," cried Brass faintly, as he again applied himself to the odious pipe. "But if he should get better, Mr. Quilp?" "Then we shall stop till he does, and no longer," returned the dwarf. "How kind it is of you, sir, to wait till then," said Brass. "Some people, sir, would have sold or removed the goods, oh dear, the very instant the law allowed him. Some people, sir, would have been all flintiness and granite. Some people, sir, would have. Some people would have spared themselves the jabbering of such a parrot as you," interposed the dwarf. "He he he," cried Brass. "You have such spirits." The smoking sentinel at the door interposed in this place, and without taking his pipe from his lips, growled, "Here's the gal a-comin' down." "The what, you dog?" said Quilp. "The gal," returned the boy.